Golf Weekly
from Off the Ball.
Brought to you by the Off the Ball Open in Abu Dhabi this November. Book your place now at offtheball.com/open.
Oh, wow! In your life have you seen anything like that?
I'm a very confident front runner. I've caddied for 33 years, 145 wins now, and that's the best win I've ever had.
I have no idea what you have.
I don't know. How are we going to count all the shots? I can't keep track.
Fuck! God damn it.
I don't think he's pleased.
Of course I would. That's a particularly stupid question. It's the Irish Open. Of course I want to play at the weekend.
Welcome along, Golf Weekly listeners. You're very welcome. We're very happy. We have Nathan Murphy alongside myself in the studio. Nathan, hello.
How are you?
And Fionn Davenport, hello.
Gentlemen.
Just the 10 major wins in 12 years. Just the 10. What do you got, rest of the world? Not much. Not much. South Africa, a measly third place on the rankings of major wins over the last 12 years. They have 4. We have 10. USA no one cares about. So that makes us, I think, number one.
USA have 25.
Do they have 25?
25.
It's just not fair. We have interviewed Shane Lowry. There's a Shane Lowry interview at the end of this podcast. So if you want to flick ahead and get to that first, we won't hold that against you. You may have already heard it in Off the Ball on Tuesday night, hence we're sticking it at the end of this podcast. We are due to speak to Neil Manship today, so we're hoping that comes through for us in about 20 minutes' time. And we'll bring you some of what Rory McIlroy was saying over in Memphis. But obviously we've got to start with an extraordinary win for Shane Lowry. Fionn, I was making the point in Off the Ball, every major win is very impressive in its own way, but this was not a guy going out on Sunday morning and posting a score and getting lucky with dodgy weather conditions. This was somebody who effectively led wire to wire, was really in the teeth of the competition from the opening round, who on the Saturday had the ability to go really low. And not every player has the ability to go low. Jack Nicklaus, Dermot Gleeson was saying to us, didn't often go really low, as great a player as he was. So Lowry went really low on the Saturday, had to sleep on a 4-shot lead, which is no easy thing, and then came out in the opposite type of conditions on the Sunday and grinded his way around brilliantly. So it was a complete test of a golfer, and it makes it such an impressive win. 6 shots against the best players in the world. It's a complete annihilation.
I couldn't agree more. And if you take out, with all respect to Shane Lowry, he isn't one of the top 10 players in the world. So let's substitute his name for DJ, Jordan Spieth, Tiger Woods, or Rory McIlroy. This would be an example of their greatness. Mm. This would be an example of their ability to absolutely impose their will on, as you say, like the best field in the world. So from the Thursday, Lowry lays down this superb marker. And I will admit that on Thursday night, as well as he played on Thursday, I texted you guys and I said, you know, it's a shame. I don't think Larry's going to hold on against this field. Well, how wrong could I be? Played brilliantly on Friday, but that's only an appetizer for what he did on Saturday. And then on Sunday, and I know that I'm sure you've talked about it an awful lot, but the idea that you have to sit on this lead, the idea that you have that churn in your brain about how you're going to perform on Sunday with this 4-shot lead, knowing that whether you like it or not, the shadow of Oakmont is somewhere lingering away in your consciousness. And to post the second best score of the afternoon tee times when they got the absolute worst of the weather. So it's not as if Lowry stumbled over the line or everyone else kind of fell away around him, although certainly people did fall away around him. But Lowry posted a one over in unbelievably difficult conditions, which, with the exception of Finau's round, is the best posted. So Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, this is the performance of a golfer that goes down for the ages, I think. It is one of the best. It's not Tiger at 2000, maybe, but it's not a million miles off it. And just the ability to just dominate both the course and this stellar field.
I'm glad you started on just the actual golf, because it has probably been lost in the hysteria and the emotion of, firstly, Sunday, but then the celebrations, which nobody has ever seen the like of, which I'm sure we'll get onto. As Fionn says, like, this was an outstanding golfing performance. Yeah. Saturday's round is arguably the greatest round of golf any Irish player has ever produced.
I agree.
Harrington at Birkdale in the final round. And McIlroy obviously destroyed Fields.
Congressional.
But this, what happened on 15, 16, 17 was almost this surreal, out-of-body experience of, did that just happen? On this unbelievably tough stretch, I know the conditions were benign, he's just grabbed hold of this Open Championship because it was a nervous watch. It felt as though disaster was lurking around any corner and that a double bogey, and he was in such a flow and he had such a smile on his face that if one thing went wrong, it could all fall apart. And to kick on 15, 16 and 17 with those birdies was just, it was one of the most enjoyable half an hours of television I've ever watched. And Fionn touched on it all week to start, put himself in contention, followed him for a good chunk of Friday, and conditions were quite miserable.
Really tough.
Really, really tough. Really tough. And just the thing that struck me watching him on Friday was how content he looked. And that seems to be the big change in him over the past year, that he just is loving his golf and accepting of his golf. Kind of noticeable at the Irish Open as well. Seemed a lot more chilled out around the Irish Open this year. And we should have read more into his form probably heading into this week, because he was physically sick at the Irish Open, having started really well on the first day. But he was playing with Phil Mickelson, and Mickelson was obviously literally looked like a man who hadn't eaten in 6 days. He looked like he couldn't concentrate, and there didn't seem like there was a huge amount of conversation going on the tee boxes, and it was very slow. There were a couple of groups behind Harrington, and there were these long breaks. They were standing on the tee box for 7-8 minutes. And Larry just had this perma-smile, looking around the galleries, just never stopped talking to himself and Bo, constant conversation, but just this sort of attitude of, you know what, as he said, I think on Saturday, like, this may never happen again. I'm going to enjoy this. I'm going to embrace the crowd. All these people want me to do well. They're not standing waiting for me to make a mistake, to have a dig. Actually, I can use it for a force of good. Yeah. And on Saturday, even to have the realisation, walking down, was it 16, 17 on Saturday, to turn to Bo and say, we need to enjoy this half an hour. Something like this may never happen again. And he was right.
Yeah.
Because Sunday was a different experience. What we saw on Saturday, I don't think will ever happen again. Probably much like Rory McIlroy on Friday. So to produce that level of golf, to go around in 63, under that amount of pressure, in front of the home crowd, is right up there among the greatest Irish rounds of golf. And then I was fortunate enough on Sunday to follow them for almost all the round. And aside from the first hole, I was never worried. There was no great tension at all. Maybe it was that the conditions were so poor and everyone's sort of concentrating on keeping out of the wind and the rain. And like, I should reinforce, I'm sure it looked bad on television. It was the sort of conditions for that half hour, 40 minute spell where he did drop a few shots, but where Fleetwood couldn't put on any pressure. If that was on a Parkland course, they wouldn't have been playing. Like, it was absolute torrential bucketing down rain and strong gale force winds. There's no way they would have been playing. So like, he must have been nervous at that stage, because it can become a little bit of a lottery. But once there wasn't that three-shot swing on the first hole, it never felt that Fleetwood got any momentum to put him under pressure. And just looked calm. Like, that first tee shot was... I was worried about him for that first tee shot from early on. I stood in the first fairway for about half an hour, 40 minutes, when Gray McDowell was there.
Yeah.
And everybody, because of the way the crosswind was coming back at them, was coming up around 25, 30 yards short of the bunkers. So they were only making the fairway by about 20 yards. Like, I'm not even sure if Lowry, if he got it on the fairway, would have made the fairway. It was right at the back left-hand corner. So I think I saw someone saying, like, the ball never went over head height off the tee.
Yeah.
So there were clearly some nerves. But the fact that Fleetwood, I'd say, has huge regrets about what happened on Sunday. He wasn't quite Paul Casey in St. Andrews in 2010, this passive observer who seemed happy to just be alongside Louis Westhuizen. He never held a putt. Every moment he had, he never held a putt. And the crowd were never nervous. There was never that air of tension I sort of expected.
Same.
Of Shane Lowry's about to do this. It could blow up at any minute. There was just this calm of, you know what, he's going to get this done.
Like, I would say some neutral observers not from Ireland might have found the whole thing a little bit boring for a good chunk of the Sunday, maybe until the celebration started, and then people realised how special it was. But I agree, there was no tension. Fleetwood never really landed a blow. And the crucial thing for me, and I suspect Larry noticed this as well, was once Brooks Koepka, of all the names there lurking, once Koepka started with bogey, 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 inconceivable, then I thought, we're on here. this is actually going to be okay. And I think by the time Larry was teeing off, he would have known that Koepka had started bogey, bogey, bogey. And then the other one was imminent as well. I would say that calmed him down no end, because I remember being in here on the Sunday to cover it, and I was just giving an update midway through the paper review. And I said, OK, Larry's about to tee off. We have this guy and this, this guy and this. And I kept going down, and I actually said out loud on air, hang on, where's Koepka? He was the only name I was kind of worried about. And once he was gone, yeah, that was a real sliding doors moment on that first green. That could have changed the whole feel of the day. But you saw the fist pump on one. And I agree, from then on, Fionn, it was a case of waiting for the inevitable, and I was never really worried about him. Fleetwood couldn't really make the pressure materialise. You're not meant to win by six shots. You're not meant to whack it up 18 and start whipping the crowd up into a frenzy.
But he's the fifth player in 100 years to win by six shots.
At all.
Or more.
Yeah.
If it weren't for the delight I felt for Lowry and just... And I was envious of Nathan being there and kind of sensing just this incredible excitement that was building up. I felt for Fleetwood. You know, I like Tommy Fleetwood. I think he's a terrific golfer. I love his attitude. I love the way he plays.
I think he was a great partner for Lowry.
Yeah. And I think they get on well, given that they hugged each other at the end. So clearly they have a relationship that's friendly, if not they're actual friends. Fleetwood couldn't nail a putt. Like, and in fairness, if you go back to the Saturday, Fleetwood's putting woes really started on 12. Like, he was doing fine, but he just couldn't put the putts down. So the conditions played into Larry, because maybe on a parkland course where you're going to get a bit of rain or maybe a bit of breeze, like the late starters who are X shots back have a better chance of coming at you. But like on a links course, when it starts to howl, not a hope. Mm. And I mean, Koepka, I'm like you, Joe. I was kind of keeping an eye out to see what Koepka was doing. And once he posted those four bogeys, which I was quite surprised by, I figured, all right, that's the end of it. And once Larry made his bogey putt on the first, that was it for me. I was like, okay, he's home and hosed. Mm. And I know it seems a bit early to say that, but like you guys, I watched it here and I never felt... I was texting a friend of mine who was going, are you not a bit worried? And I was like, nah, not really. Mm. But then I was thinking, am I just deluded?
We had Harrington on the show at 1 o'clock, so about 45 minutes before Larry teed off. And I put that same point to him. I was totally of the opinion, this bad weather is good for Larry. Mm. It's very hard for somebody to come from deep to catch him. Mm. And he accepted it to a point, and really only to a point, because he said, the one thing Shane likes is simple golf. He didn't mean that in a derogatory way. Yeah, just Shane likes a bit of simplicity. It's either a hard seven or a soft eight, and let's leave it at that. What bad weather does in a links course is complicates things massively and gives you a lot of things to think about. And is this the right club, and is this the right shot shape? And so it complicates things massively, and that wouldn't necessarily suit Larry. So, yeah, for sure, it would make it very hard for somebody to come from deep, but it would, by the same token, hasten the chances of Larry coming back to the field, and that never happened.
Yeah, I think in hindsight, certainly the weather did suit him. My sense on Saturday night when the forecast was bad was that if he was level with Tommy Fleetwood, he probably would have been quite happy for the weather to deteriorate. Mm. But the fact he had a four-shot lead and the conditions predicted to be as bad as they got,
yeah,
it did bring in an element of lottery, and the ball can just spin off the club face and disaster strikes and you drop three shots in a hole. Now, it never happened, but that there was maybe an element of luck came into it. I think you're right about playing with Fleetwood. If he was playing with Koepka, it would have been a very different atmosphere, because everybody loves Fleetwood. Mm. Not that they don't like Koepka, but it would have turned into, I think, a more of a us v you, and the crowd probably would have been a bit more hostile towards Koepka, and there would have been a bit more of an edge to it. Where actually, like, it was, again, I can't stress enough, the calmest, most polite final round I've ever seen.
At one point, Larry's caught walking off one of the greens and he shouts to Fleetwood's caddy, Fleetwood's caddy, we get the Sambos out. What is this? You know, it totally seemed like it was bereft of any edge. Mm. And if Koepka was there, there would have been massive match play edge. And in the interview we'll play out with Larry later on, he saw Fleetwood, who he's very friendly with, good friends with, saw him in the locker room on Saturday, and he felt comfortable enough to go up to him and say, let's both have a good crack at this tomorrow and hopefully one of us wins. That was the atmosphere. Now, you ain't going up to Koepka and saying that.
No. The only thing that annoyed me throughout, and this is just me being tense, was that when Larry was walking from green to tee, all of the, now, not the kids, anyone over 18 years old who's trying to give him the hand clap, I'm like, just leave him alone, will you? He's in his zone. And then I think, I can't remember whether it was on 15 or walking tour 15 or 16, this one guy with a beard, wasn't you, Nathan, with a beard, tries for the hand clap, nothing. Tries for the fist bump, nothing. And then leans out and almost like tips over the ropes just to hit him on the back. And it was like, and now I understand if it was me, you're carried away in the excitement. But like, I was just so petrified that anything would break his concentration that I was like, I found myself watching it here on TV going, leave him alone.
Yeah.
Stop doing that. So,
do you know, I had a thought, and it's a pity there's no way to measure what percentage of the crowd were from the Republic, what percentage of the Northern Irish crowd there were Protestant and firmly of the Unionist disposition. Because it must have struck a lot of people, I'm sure it struck you, Fionn, you know, you're a keen follower of politics and been around the block a bit longer than us, so you've seen it all. Like, there was something kind of magical about Olé, Olé, a Portrush. Graham McDowell said to Nathan at one point, you know, they took him as one of their own. And that was kind of a special thing, a momentous thing. It's hard to extrapolate much from it. It's hard to say what that means. I mean, it's just a moment in time. And when it comes to sport, especially because the Golfing Union is across all 32 counties, it's not surprising. But it was an aspect of the day that added a touch of magic to the whole thing that couldn't have been there in a Muirfield or in Roy Lytham and St. Anne's or anywhere else.
No, absolutely not. I think you make a good point. And what it does, and I agree, we're not meant to be surprised, because anyone who has followed golf in this country know it's like, let's say, for example, you get a bunch of diehard unionists come down to Lansdowne Road for rugby international. Like, and Sean O'Brien plays particularly well. Are you going to cheer him less because he comes from a different background to yours? Absolutely not. We don't assume any difference. Golf is exactly the same. And whilst absolutely I agree to hear the olé olés chanted at Portrush. Royal Portrush. It is also a reminder that golf is a national sport here. And Gary Lineker tweeted, like, I'm a big fan of Gary Lineker on Twitter, but like, it was idiotic what he was tweeting. Like, it's called the British Open and Rory McIlroy's British. And you're like, first of all, it isn't. And second of all, it isn't. You know, it's the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. So whatever your alignment are, you're still Irish. And it just seemed... And the other thing pointing out is that, like, you know, it's like not a lot of drummer boys from East Belfast are showing up at Portrush to watch golf, I would imagine.
Okay.
And
I wouldn't even know that. Why not? Why not?
Well, because golf is not a... Working class
sport. Okay.
No, it isn't. Or certainly, it wouldn't have a lot of cachet in the kind of the working class neighborhoods of East or West Belfast. Mm. Portrush, Royal Portrush, is the preserve of a gentried elite. You know, it's a very elite golf club, and it's you know, and so the people who show up there. Now, having said that, because it's the Open, you get fans from all over. You just get golf fans, and I think that. And I think what it did was is it just served to... We should not be surprised in the least that you had hundreds of thousands of people all chanting Shane Lowry's name because that's just the way it is.
Mm. Most people just want a quiet, normal life.
Yeah, they really do. It's absolutely true.
No, it's true.
I mean, it is worth pointing out here is that... I mean, Northern Ireland was a big winner. Like, huge, you know? Mm. I mean, it really kind of represented itself very, very well. Portrush is a very, very big winner. I read the contract has that it has to have two more opens before 2040.
Mm.
And here's the thing. I was reading some of the things and they're saying that Lytham, God bless Lytham, Lytham is just overpowered by golfers. So there is talk maybe that Lytham is going to fall afoul of modern golf. And Muirfield, you know, so will Portrush all of a sudden get into the rota, a regular contender based on this week? I don't see why not.
I don't think there's any question that it's going to be. In fact, Graham McDowell said on Sunday that he'd heard whispers. He was asked the question. Now, James Corrigan mentioned this as he pulled me up on Twitter about it. Graham McDowell mentioned that he'd heard possibly 5 years' time.
Which seemed very quick to me.
And again, I think that's the Lytham Muirfield question that probably they would have been one of the ones hosting that year. Let's be honest, though. Like, it's I don't think they're going to drop Lytham because it's being overpowered. They're going to go back to Portrush because they made an absolute bucket load of money.
Yeah.
They had incredible attendances that after the success of this, it'll be even harder to get tickets if it is there in 5 years' time. Yeah. I was in the merchandise tent at lunchtime on Sunday, and it was like Dawn of the Dead. Like, there was nothing under about €80 left. It was insane how much stuff was gone. Like, there was no chance of getting a 18th green flag or anything like that. So they obviously, it was a huge financial success, and this is the big payday of the year for the RNA. So if they can go back time and time again.
I was talking to Paul Casey the day of Rory's double bogey and won. Interesting, he didn't realise they were out of
quadruple
bounds.
Quadruple bogey, sorry.
Yeah, my God. Quadruple bogey on one. He didn't realise they were out of bounds on the first Paul Casey, which I just still can't believe. He was laughing to himself saying, yeah, my prep maybe wasn't so hot there. But he was saying he'd have it number two already on the Rota in terms of the courses he's played, and he's played them all. He said he's a massive Harry Colt fan. Everything about it, he was saying, makes sense. There are no bunkers there for no good reason. It all works. It just works as a piece of artistry and a piece of design, and he couldn't say enough good things about it. Interestingly, actually, on that Thursday, I said, what do you think is going to win? He said, what are we at now? 4 under? Double it, add two? He was like, I'd say about, if you gave me 10 under now, he said on Thursday, if you gave me 10 under, I'd bite your hand off.
It would have been another runners-up finish for you, Paul, wouldn't it? That's Harrington down the Irish Open, at least, was when he was asked, because, Paul, you're a very good judge of what winning score will be. He's like, you know, what do you think the winning score in La Hinch will be this week? And he's like, he talks for about 5 minutes, and he's like, to be honest, I don't have a clue.
Yeah.
Like, who knows?
Yeah.
Like, it could be 10 under, 20 under.
Yeah.
Like, who knows?
Yeah.
I think, Nathan, you're dead right. I think, what did it have, the second highest attendances of an Open Championship ever?
Yeah, 237,000.
So 237,000. Muirfield got 140,000 the last time it hosted. As you say, it's numbers. It's a numbers game. And if the RNA can make a ton of money out of Portrush, it'll be a definite contender for regular appearances in the Rota. Oddly enough, though, did you see that on NBC, the figures were way down? For very obvious reasons, but no Tiger, no Rory. Well, no Tiger. So there's this weird kind of contradiction where you have like the most successful Open Championship, bar one, in modern times, and a kind of a dud ratings on American TV, which I'm assuming the RNA are quite mindful of, because let's not kid ourselves, if you can't keep the Americans happy, golf is not happy.
But that's, you know, that's nothing to do with the course. As
no, absolutely not.
It's that.
No, that's to do with the
saying from last year that Tiger Woods doesn't move the dial. Tiger Woods is the dial. And when Tiger is stinking the joint out, Americans, they probably tune in for 5 minutes and go, oh, that looks lovely.
If Koepka was within a shot of Lowry with eight holes to go, that probably livens things up as well.
It is a great course. I know you played up there quite recently, and it was probably not talked about that much as the weekend went on. I thought on Thursday, though, instantly we're like, yes, this is an Open Championship course. This is, there's four or five holes that are so memorable that instantly you know what's a good shot. Like, what they did to the fifth hole out onto the ocean.
Well, so I played that. I made a par in that hole. Okay? Yeah.
Well, most people would have an eagle putt.
So I remember that hole very well, for obvious reasons, because I didn't play especially well that day. But I remember that hole, and I hit a good drive and found, you know, got over the hump to make the fairway. It was a big deal to make that fairway. That was the aggressive line with me and my playing group. If you had said to me then, by the way, you realise this is going to be this really cool, funky hole that they drive with the risk of OB just over the sea, I would have said, no. What? Like, it's just insane to me watching on TV to think, hang on, we were all stood on the tee, probably not the tee they're stood on, and saying to ourselves, can we get over that hump? Can we reach the fairway? And for these lads,
they're
it's like...
They're having to dial down.
They're gripping down on their driver. When you have a course that on the Thursday has scores on holes ranging from a hole-in-one to a 13... then you kind of have to say, geez, that's delivering. Like, that is punishing you viciously for bad shots. And equally, good shots are really rewarded.
Did they not give David Duval a 14 for that hole?
Oh, I can't remember. It changed.
I think it ended up in a 14 at the end.
Yeah. There were people criticising Duval for playing, saying, like...
Well, Alan Shipnuck was, who I think has since said, listen, I'm friendly with David Duval and he does brilliant things for the game and he has his place in the game.
Yeah.
But that he shouldn't be playing the Open Championship because he doesn't play enough golf the rest of the year.
Yeah.
That actually... if he was a regular on the seniors tour, like a lot of the former winners are, then fine. But he's coming in far too rusty. And you look at the last 3 years, he shot over 80 in the first round. Previous few years, he withdrew after the first round. He's taken up somebody else's spot. This year, he took Martin Keimer's spot, shall we say. Martin Keimer, and there was this correlation between winning in Abu Dhabi and people who played well in Portrush. So Shane Lowry obviously won in Abu Dhabi this year. Tommy Fleetwood won in Abu Dhabi last year. I think JB Donaldson won in Abu Dhabi the year he won the Irish Open in Portrush. Martin Keimer's won three times in Abu Dhabi.
Okay.
So he was there all week as well, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, was practicing. He was first alternative. So for that reason. But David Duval has won the Open Championship.
100%.
He can do what he wants.
I actually think it's a great aspect of majors when you get to see the former champions. There's a touch of nostalgia. Yeah. You get to see them hitting a shot. And like, okay, he may not be playing enough golf now. He may not be playing, you know, doing enough to earn it now. But like, he's spent an entire lifetime earning an Open title. It's a brilliant aspect of the majors. And frankly, you know, Martin Keimer, if you want to be in the Open that much, there's enough spots. Play your way in, you should get in. Like, that's just the deal. I've no issue whatsoever. I've no problem with, you know, Calcavecchia hitting one out of bounds. Or was it O'Meara? One of them hit it out of bounds 2 years ago on the opening tee shot. I've no problem with that whatsoever. I think it's really cool that Larry's going to be there in 27 years' time hitting a shot. You know, that's kind of the deal.
It is, and that was great when he mentioned that in his press conference. He's like, my daughter's going to be 30 when I finish playing here.
Yeah.
I mean, I agree with you guys, but I think Shipnuck has a point. I think if you're not a regular player, whether on the senior tour or on any other tour, like if you're just a part-time golfer, I don't know. Yeah, and I take your point about Keimer. If you wanted to play your way in, you're good enough. But I think there's right on both, to be honest.
Okay.
I understand Shipnuck's point.
We've got to get on to lots of stuff. Rory McIlroy has given a very interesting press conference in Memphis. WGC right upon us. Adair Manor is going to get the Ryder Cup. We are busy. And there's Evian Championship in France. The ladies are playing two majors in back-to-back weeks. So we're going to touch on all that. But in just a moment, we're delighted to say we're going to bring you a chat with Neil Manship. So I'm told he's on the line. Neil Manship, you're there.
Hi, Joe. How are you?
Very well. I'd say you're doing all right.
Very well, yeah. We're all on cloud nine, as you can imagine, along with the rest of the country who are big into golf, and even a lot of people who weren't into golf before now are.
I'd say you're all a bit taken aback by the extent of the homecoming and the celebration and how wild everyone's gone. A bit mad, eh?
Yeah, it really was absolutely fantastic. Great to see so many people out in Clara the other night. It really was an amazing reception for Shane and his family. It's hard to put into words how incredible it was, how many people were there on the overall celebration.
Where are you now? Is it back to normal life? Are you at a Carton House?
No, I'm at Athlone Golf Club. We have the Interpros on here this week, under 14s, under 16s and under 18s. So out watching some of the emerging talent out here.
Jeez, it never stops.
Never stops, yeah. It's all go.
Talk to us then. Like, there's so many things we want to ask you about. I mean, your conversation with Shane on Wednesday in Bushmills has been referenced several times. Shane was on the show on Tuesday and he said, like, it was very helpful. It's a conversation you two would have lots of times, you know, before lots of tournaments. And obviously when you go and win a tournament, it almost elevates the importance of it. Can you give us a sense of the conversation from your point of view?
No, I think that's right. It's a conversation we would nearly always have before events or in between rounds or after the event. I guess it was around just putting the week in perspective, what it meant, how we were going to go about our business, how he was going to approach his game, and some tactics around the course, and really just getting in the right headspace for the week ahead, which for everybody involved was just a massive week. And it was incredible to have the Open at Royal Portrush, a brilliant venue that Shane really loves, and he was really excited about doing well. And obviously the anxiety that everyone would have of not wanting to do badly and trying to get off to a good start, and really just commentary around that kind of thing.
When you talk about tactics there, Neil, Shane also mentioned that, you know, he would see at certain points you and Bo Martin, his caddy, in conversation, you know, before a round and looking at pin sheets or looking at strategy and bits and bobs like that. How much of that does he dictate, Shane himself dictate, that I'm going to hit this club here and I want to, you know, go at the course this way, versus how much input you and Bo might have in terms of what you think is the best way to go about a course? How does all that work on a given week?
It was really, Shane is fantastic at working his way around a course, and he's very good in practice rounds, or at noticing places where not to go, noticing good attack angles, maybe on certain greens or from certain runoff areas, or trying to get to certain pins. Maybe we'd look at those leading up to the week. And myself and Bo then would just discuss how the pins are for today and any areas we thought were tricky. But really, it would all be driven by Shane. And he'd, on course, he'd obviously be seeking Bo's advice if he was about to do anything really unusual, which very rarely happens. But, I mean, Bo is a great source of support as well for pointing him in the right direction.
Shane mentioned as well on Sunday, I think, you went for a walk again just to try and figure things out, and he was understandably a little bit anxious with a four-shot lead heading into the final round. That role that you have then, it's obviously not just as a swing coach, as a regular coach, that being that sounding board from, have you always been that since he had that Irish Open success? Would this be a regular every week at a tournament that you'd spend a bit of time together and just sort of clear his head?
Yeah, not always in places as pretty as Bush Mills along the river there. It was very nice, nice Sunday morning. We just went for a walk along the river to discuss the day ahead, and really all scenarios that could happen were likely to happen. We talked about the weather, the likely impact that might have, and not making any assumptions. The really bad weather could have come in, maybe we'd have missed it. And we just talked around, you know, the importance of seeing the whole thing in the general perspective again, of looking the short term, this is a massive deal here and you're in a great position. And, you know, in the longer term, also not to put too much emphasis on it and just keep playing your game the way you have been and be prepared to be, you know, level after four or five holes, or maybe you might be six or seven ahead after four or five holes. You just don't know how it's going to end up. But really just preparing for every likelihood to come around just so you're not shocked by anything, you're not surprised by anything that happens and puts you out of your stride.
Neil, do you have a sports psychology background at all, or have you had to learn this and develop this over time?
No, I don't. No, I've done a few courses here and there with in kind of areas regarded to that, but I certainly don't have any professional qualification in that regard. I guess a lot of it comes from playing the game myself and coaching all the guys on the squad and coaching Shane for so many years, and a lot of it comes from understanding how he goes about his business and what he does when he's at his best. And sometimes things that happen that put him out of stride a little bit, and just generally a kind of bank of understanding over so many years and how he best goes about his business. But at the same time, you can't try and be too smart about it. You don't know what's going to happen. You don't know how it's going to unfold. I think what we'll always try to do is talk everything through, talk all the scenarios through, just so that he's prepared for anything to come along. Because you never know how it's going to go, do you? I mean, even the first hole was a great example where Shane held a great 8-footer to stay three ahead of Tommy that made par. I mean, that was a really good, really good start for him after a shaky start off the tee in second shot, and really helped his position going forward, and made a few birdies then leading up to the seventh, and then the really bad weather came in and it was going to be really hard then for anybody to make any progress.
I guess
it's just preparing for all possible scenarios.
I'm just thinking of, say, the Saturday night, and I know it was quite late when everybody gets back to the house, but there's probably that sort of situation where when Shane's around, everybody has to say one thing and then he leads the room, and you can probably be honest with each other, yourself and all the backroom team and the family, about just how nervous ye are about the whole occasion. What was that like as a group who've probably got to know each other so well over the last 10, 15 years, as to seeing what he could achieve in the Sunday, and how nervous an experience and a day it was for ye?
Well, I mean, Saturday evening was just incredible, the crowds that were out there for the Saturday evening golf. It's quite a late finish. I think maybe teed off about 10 to 4, so it must have been around 8 o'clock, something like that. But just the crowds behind the media area at the end were just amazing. And, of course, Shane had a brilliant finish, birdie in 15, 16, 17, to put himself in that position. So, you know, everybody was going mad. It was like the final day of the tournament. It was like it was won already. So we really just had to enjoy that and then gather ourselves again later on in the evening and just get ready for the day ahead. And also the tee-off times being pushed up a couple hours helped as well. Because a four-shot lead, you know, is a lovely thing to have, but when it comes down to it, it's really not that much. So the two-hour tee-off times going ahead by a couple hours was helpful as well. I think for everybody, sitting around thinking about it is the worst thing, so the sooner round four came on, the better.
Did you feel bad weather was good for you with a four-shot lead, or bad? We were just toying around with that earlier. There's an upside and a downside. Were you kind of happy to see bad weather or no?
Again, preparing for everything. On the Saturday, the weather was amazing.
Yeah.
It was flat calm, there was hardly a breath. It was really good scoring conditions. So in that position, people can make great strides forward. And when the bad weather comes in, it's really more a matter of trying to avoid any disasters and carrying on playing very sensible shots and going through his routine. And you'd probably say on balance it was an advantage, because it was very hard for anybody to make any strong progress. You could really see everybody falling away on the leaderboard. It just shows how good his round was on that day.
Yeah.
That so many great players fell away and just couldn't cope with the conditions as well as he did.
Neil, there was a very striking comment from Shane I wanted to get your perspective on. he said that he wasn't so sure he was good enough to win a major. He thought maybe, you know, have a chance, but he really wasn't so sure. He said the one person who was absolutely sure he would win a major and told him he would win a major was you. And I must say, looking on, like, we all knew how good he was. Like, you see the talent and the short game. Nobody can expect, you know, you're going to win the Open by six shots in that manner. And equally, I would look at him and see all the talent, you know. But think, God, he should have won more, you know. Like, this, you know, over 10 years, I know how hard it is to win, but, like, he's that good. What was it about him? What is it about his game? Because we know how good the other guys out there are. Like, there are the Brooks Koepkas of the world. What was it that made you think this guy really can win a major?
Well, over the years, yes, I would have. I mean, somewhere between nobody knows 100% for sure until it absolutely happens. Somewhere between believing very strongly and knowing for sure that he will and has won majors, and I believe he'll win more. His overall skills, I mean, he's a very good driver of the ball, excellent putter, very good iron player. Everyone knows how good a short game can be. So that was a big part of it. But obviously the heart that he has, the commitment to his game and to improving that he has, all of those factors combined. And just that intangible thing of just somebody who's so good at whatever they do, it's hard to put into words why you believe in them so much. And we looked during some of the low times that we would have had over his career, we would have discussed around this to say, look, there's no panic in the short term. You're going to win major championships. Who knows when it's going to be or when it's going to happen or where it's going to happen. But it's going to happen if we just keep going about our businesses sensibly, keep learning as we go along, and to a certain extent, let it happen and not try to force it to happen.
We were touching them. You know Pete Cowan when he came out to the GUI? Were you there back then, kind of 04, 05 territory?
Yeah, back in 2005, that's right.
Yeah. Could you tell us about that interaction? Because we kind of, you know, Dermot Leese mentioned it to us, that he definitely saw something in Shane. Where was Shane at that stage in his career?
So he would have just gone up to the men's national squad from the boys' national squad the previous year. So he really would have just been, I think he won the Leinster boys that year and pushed on to the men's team then and made the Leinster into pro team immediately after that, and then the men's national team after that. So that would have been around that period when he was just making that transition from boys to men.
Right. And so Cowan sees him play and says, you realise you've got something here?
Yeah, we had Pete came over for a couple of sessions at Carton House. We had some great discussions, did some short game, played on course a fair bit. So Rory was by far the number one at that stage and was already very winning national championships and going on to his stellar career, and Pete noticed, and just the way Shane swung the club and the way he went about his business, that he was certainly one to watch out for, and he was right about that.
He sure was. And did that come as news to all you guys there, or were you kind of nodding along saying, yeah, tell us about it, we know?
No, I remember him saying to me and kind of nodding ahead and saying, that lad's not bad, is he? And it was just, you know, something as gentle as that, but a recognition that he stood out from the crowd a little bit, along with Rory. No, just something like that. It was nothing too specific, just saying he had some respect for what he was doing. Mm.
You mentioned Pete Cowan there. It was interesting, been on the range over the weekend and even around the course, watching the dynamic Shane has with people around him. And you see the likes of Pete Cowan and Claude Harmon are around their players and they're sort of floating in and out. And there's not a huge amount of conversation. Maybe Cameron McCormack soon a little bit more with Jordan Spieth. It seemed watching Shane on the range that he's in constant conversation with you. And then out on the course, it felt as though himself and Beau never stopped talking. Every time Tommy Fleetwood was preparing for a shot, the two of them were having a little bit of a laugh. They had a big smile on their face. That they were maybe... Are you just keeping his mind occupied there? Is that the way you like to work it on the range in advance, that he's not actually just left to his own devices, that there's a lot going on?
Yeah, it's a pretty lonely stage, really. And with a player like him, it's just great to have everything out in the open and talk things through. So even in practice rounds, we would talk every single shot through, come up with a good target, where we want to see the ball coming down, what his strategy is for this shot. So that in practice rounds, you're really simulating what it's going to be like in the tournament. Now, you don't have the pressures of it or the competition of it, but you know, you're really playing each shot as if it is in the tournament. And similar in the range, a lot of the range is a warm-up before the Shane would typically be hit between 40 and 50 balls before going out, between wedge shots and drivers and iron shots. Yeah, I'm picking targets and just keeping through the same process all the time.
Geez, a year's a long time in sport. If I'm not mistaken, you were doing a spot of caddy in a Carnoustie last year.
That's right, yeah.
That was a low point, I'm sure. How different is his game? What's the difference in his game? I know golf, we're talking about the finest of margins, Neil, but you know, you think how dark that time was, and it wasn't easy for anyone concerned, and Dermot and everybody who'd been there. Like, is there just a marked difference in the kind of shots he's hitting? Is it his attitude? Can you put your finger on the big difference?
No, a lot of composure, I would see. I think for any not fantastic sportsman or woman, excuse me, just going from a golf point of view, I was thinking through every, whether it's a 2-foot putt or a drive or a 6-iron shot out the rough, just thinking every shot through very clearly, coming up with clear targets. So there's a really lot of clarity around every single shot that he plays. So that's one of the things that is... Sorry, I'm losing my voice here.
You're all right.
One of the things that's helped him just be more deliberate and consistent in his approach to his game. And a lot of that comes with a bit of maturity. He's been playing on tour for 10 years and really understands the game very well. Mm. Scheduling is very difficult between playing in the PGA Tour and the European Tour. So obviously he's got an amazing schedule there for the next few years after winning the Open. But just clearing up little things like that can just make life a little bit more difficult. And then when it comes down to the golf course, got some peace of mind. So really thinking each shot through clearly, coming up with good targets. And as the saying goes, playing one shot at a time. And if you're 1 over after 5, play the next shot. If you're 4 under after 5, play the next shot. It doesn't make any difference. So it's kind of as clinical as that, I would say, is one of the reasons why he's getting a bit more out of himself.
Yeah.
The consistency is a huge thing as well over the last 6 months. I was having a look earlier today at Data Golf and some of the shots gained statistics. So in Shane's first 10 years as a professional up until January this year, there were 15 rounds in those 10 years where he gained 4 shots on the field.
Okay.
In 2019 already, he has 11 rounds where he's gained 4 shots on the field. And I guess, I'm sure you read a lot more into these statistics, gaining 4 shots on the field is probably where you need to be if you're going to be contending in tournaments.
Yes, yeah, very much so. And whether it's off the tee or whether it's strokes gained putting, which he would rank very high in both tours, and the proximity to the hole with his iron shots. You know, just really, for every golfer, just really refining each part of your game and holding a few more between 3 and 6 feet, you know, hitting your iron shots a little bit closer, getting in position off the tee more often. All of those tiny little bits and pieces can make up to a big difference at the end of the day.
Just one last one from me, Neil, if it's all right, and you'll be probably digging into your psychology books and maybe picking the brain of Padraig Harrington, because he tells this, you know, great story about Paul Laurie after Laurie had won the 99 Open, that the Van der Velde won, and they were playing some course and par 3, and Laurie hits a shot and it's not a good shot, misses the green, and he berates himself and he says, "Paul, that is not the shot of an Open champion." And Harrington thought to himself, "Uh-oh, that can't be good if you're carrying that around with you." You know, Shane's in this amazing new place now where he has to reset targets and almost accept that even an Open champion might hit some bad shots, and where do you go from here and all that stuff. Have you given that some thought, and you know where you go to next? Because I guess you don't want to live in the past and you don't want to carry around a weight either. You need to almost manipulate this brilliant achievement into something very positive for him.
100%. I mean, completely enjoy the celebrations. It's a really momentous occasion, incredible Irish sporting achievement. I mean, to win the Open Championship on the island of Ireland is just an incredible dream come true. I mean, beating Tommy Fleetwood by 6 shots and beating every other best player in the world by 9 shots or more is just an incredible achievement. So absolutely enjoy the celebrations. Let it all go. And then, as you say, have a think about things, reset a little bit, have some perspective over the rest of the season, play in the States for a while in the FedEx playoffs and then back to the European Tour for the rest of the year.
Okay.
And look at the 2020 schedule after that. But no, there's no, I mean, labelling yourself as an Open champion or, the golf clubs and the golf balls don't know who you are. You know, you just influence them as best as you can. So resetting, start again. We've got the same objectives as we had before. Wins come along now and again. This has been an amazing one and a historic one, but it won't change the way it goes about its business at all. It won't change any targets for the next while. Keep doing what we're doing for the next little while and see where it goes.
Okay. I'll give a very final word to you, Fionn. You're listening away to this in Manchester. Anything you want to put to Neil?
Yeah, Neil. One of the moments that really, really impressed me was the interview that Shane gave to Tim Barter on the Saturday night when Tim asked him about Oakmont and he kind of deflected that quite well. But in which he acknowledged that the next 24 hours were going to be very, very challenging for him. But he did so in that way of, I don't know, like in Buddhism or in mindfulness, they talk about like when you have something that's troubling you, you acknowledge it, you don't push it away and pretend it's not happening, but equally you don't hold on to it. You just kind of acknowledge its existence and then operate accordingly. And it seemed to me as well, when married to that other comment that he made about like, look, if I don't win this, I still have a 2-year-old daughter. I still have my wife. I still have my life.
Exactly, yeah.
And exactly. It just seemed to create this picture of a man who is so present and so acknowledging of all of these different things. And surely this is a much more mature, experienced, I dare I say, happier, and on all round, just like this accomplished golfer than he was, say, maybe 3 years ago and certainly 10 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, he's had an absolutely fantastic family life, and of course that helps his golf game along with all the other things. And yeah, to have that perspective, to be able to say, I mean, he did an incredible press conference, I thought, on Saturday evening, where one of the American journalists asked him about Oakmont, and he had a 4-shot lead there. You know, and you blew it, pretty much, was the way it was put. Although, I mean, he did finish second in the event, didn't have the final round we wanted, but it was still a very good week. But he also had a 4-shot lead going out for Abu Dhabi this year and went into a 3-shot deficit after 11 holes and ended up winning that. So that was a help there. It wasn't immediately falling on the back of Oakmont. But to have the perspective to say, and of course, the honesty, I really want to win this tournament. I want to go out and play well today. You know, that's a fact. But also, look, if it doesn't work out, it's not the end of the world. You know, little Iris will still be there for me at the back of the 18th green. You know, and that's a great perspective to have. So, yeah, as you say, the honesty about the situation, you know, treat everything face on, not hiding away from anything. Like, I might have a really bad day today. It might not work out. I might have a fantastic day. We actually discussed he might win by 6 shots. And it turned out that way. And it was, I mean, what a privilege to have to be able to walk up the 18th fairway with that cushion and be able to really enjoy the atmosphere and enjoy the moment and not have to worry about making a par to win.
Well, listen, Neil, we'll let you go. I mean, you're hard at work, isn't it? I mean, a little glimpse into your life. I mean, you could have the feed up this week. You're out watching the under-14s. You've taken a guy, what, 12, 13, 14 years ago and brought him to this point, Open champion. What the GUI are doing is quite extraordinary. So, genuinely, a big congratulations to you and a well done to you and everybody out of the GUI, because it's amazing to do what you're doing on this stage. So thanks for your time as well.
Great, thank you. Really appreciate it. Thanks, lads.
Cheers.
Thanks, Neil.
Neil Manship there. So to wrap up, I mean, geez, what a job Manship's done, actually.
Yeah, you can tell the importance, I think, of his backroom team. Bo Martin, I think you were chatting to him at one of the homecomings. I don't think he's probably going to talk, as is the way with caddies. They like to keep the head down.
Saying, will you do anything with us? Will you give us 5 minutes? He's like, no, I don't want to detract at all from Shane's limelight. And I said, what about in a couple of months when it's all died down, when the limelight's gone? Will you do something then? And he said, no, I don't think so.
I was asking Peter Lowry earlier on, because it was the one thing I noticed following Lowry over the few days, was like they never shut up. Never.
Really?
So, like, you know, Fleet was over in the corner there at the far side of the green. I think it was second or third hole I noticed it on Sunday.
Yeah.
They're laughing, the two of them are giggling away about something. And I mentioned on Friday there was these long breaks on the tee where they'd have to wait and wait. And again, constant.
Right.
Bowl would be in his ear and Shane would be smiling away, laughing at something. And I was just saying to Peter, was he always like this? Is this, you know, one of the reasons? Because I know Peter was sort of recommending that Shane hire Bo, and he was then, well, he was younger guy just starting out, but like one of the things that makes him such a good caddy is he understands that every player is different.
Yeah.
Some players don't like the talking. Where actually, again, it was the reason I asked there, on the range, Neil just seemed to be constantly talking to Shane when he was standing over the ball. There was almost always a voice in his ear that he never had too much time to think, sit there and just be alone with his thoughts.
Yeah.
Now maybe it's one of these things that's confirmation bias because he wins the tournament.
Totally.
He misses out on, like, maybe if people had given him a moment.
We'd be sitting here going, geez, Bo, shut up a minute, man.
There was an interesting one. I mean, I know you all saw it on the Saturday, but maybe, Nathan, if you were following them, you didn't. Was it on the 15th or I can't remember whichever it was. The miracle shot that kind of, quite a miracle, but the one that came in off the left-hand side.
10th.
Hit the bank.
7-iron with the 10th, where there was a big back and forth.
That's the one. So you have this big back and forth between Bo and Shane. Now, I put on Twitter that, like, what an amazing thing to have is that where they allowed you to listen in on the conversation between the caddy and the player and to see how they figure it out. And it was very interesting to watch Bo kind of reassure Shane, no, you hit it there, this is what will happen. And sure enough, exactly as it did. But then I said it on Twitter, and someone else who was at the tournament had been following them on Friday, and he goes, well, probably a good idea that they don't mic them up all the time because, you know, they like to express themselves in a rich vernacular. So there was a sense that, like, these are lads who get on, obviously, very, very well. And as you both said, is that, like, this idea of constant chat keeps Shane kind of going. And he obviously is a chatty guy and loves kind of, like, a bit of the talk. But I would have loved to hear them mic'd up a lot more, to hear that decision-making process, because clearly, you know, obviously it worked a treat. But even if it doesn't, it's still quite interesting.
Yeah, it worked a treat that time and kind of kick-started the 63. I was saying that to Bo at the press conference Shane was having at House. So Bo was there, having a cup of soup and talking to everyone, but just doesn't want to go on air. And I was saying, have you watched any of it back? It's like, you make sure you watch the 10th from Saturday. You come out like a god. And he was
on your CV.
Oh my God, he was like, really? Go on, what happened? I was like, well, we were going through it and Shane wasn't so sure and you said, no, definitely, it'll feed down. And Shane came back again and you said, trust me, it's a 7, it'll feed down, we'll be fine. He was pretty pleased. I think Bo will be sending that video around to anyone who wants to see. This is how you caddy. Even on commentary, they did have Shane laughing and looking over at Bo saying, they'll be, you know, he'll be saying, nice club, fella. You know, it was that kind of a moment. Any kind of final thoughts? Because I think we should talk about, like, Rory's Open. We should talk about Koepka. Interestingly, Peter Lawrie felt the greens were so slow, Koepka couldn't get to grips with them because, my God, Koepka put on a ball-striking display. But is there anything else, I guess, that you want to say about Lawrie and the whole experience or where he goes from here?
Just the most incredible week for Irish golf. I never thought golf would create such hysteria around the country.
Yeah.
It'll never happen again, even if he goes and wins the Masters. The fact it was in Port Rush, I think, made all the difference.
And the celebrations. The closest thing, appropriately enough, the closest thing we'll get to, like, an All-Ireland, a golf win being celebrated like a team has won the All-Ireland, even to being in the Boar's Head. it just took on the rhythm of an All-Ireland win.
Well, it was as if he was thinking, like, how should I celebrate?
What would Offaly do?
What would they do? Here's what their plan for the day would be. And initially I thought, because I know he said in his press conference on Friday, you know, getting into his own head, I presume, of no matter what happens on Sunday, you know, I'm going to be on that flight to Memphis on Monday morning. And I was like, nah, you're not. I did think he would actually play Memphis because it is a World Golf Championship. And I sort of thought, oh, sponsors will be insisting that because he'd be the star of the show over there.
Get your Strix
on
hat.
Fair play to him.
Yeah.
Because, like, this is a once-in-a-lifetime week.
100%.
Nobody else, like, there's very few sports people in the world that are going to experience that. Like, has there ever been a major celebrated like that?
Did Harrington even have anything?
No.
I
remember Harrington coming home and he flew by private jet into
Weston.
Into Weston Aerodrome, and I remember being out there interviewing him.
Yeah.
And there was 30 journalists, the TV stations. He did a press conference, and then from what I remember, he went home.
Yeah.
I presume there was a party somewhere. But there certainly, and I presume Stackstown was packed that night. But there was no stage and 10,000 people. And, like, I was in Galway on Tuesday and I was kind of going, like, is this, will I drive up? Is this the sort of thing I should be bringing the kids to?
Yeah.
That they'll remember in years to come and go, oh, yeah, I remember I was there the night that Shane Lawrie came home. It was, like, it's just not what happens with golf tournaments. And I do think the Port Rush factor was huge, that a lot of people would have actually been in Port Rush. And, like, it was hysteria. One of the most impressive things was how he brought himself down after Saturday, which was just insanity walking off the course. I heard an interview.
You watched Love Island?
Well, I know you're a fan. I have
unseen bits on the Saturday.
Oh, really?
It tends to be funnier.
Okay, so it's more relaxing.
It's feel good.
Did he not say he'd missed it because he was home so late? But he did. I know he did probably the same interview four or five times, but he did one with the BBC 5 Live where everybody's outside going, hey, Shane, Lawrie, ooh, ah. And they're going, Shane, like, what? This is on Saturday. He's like, what is this? He's like, this isn't golf. He's like, this isn't me. Like, is this me standing here? It's just not how, like, this doesn't happen in a golf tournament.
And he is dead right to miss the WGC. He stood on a stage with his grandmother as she belted out an Offaly tune and 20,000 people lost their minds. That's never going to happen again.
Do you think, well, I'm just glad that it's the summertime and the Late Late Show is off, because otherwise they would have O'Donovan brothered him. Oof. You know?
What? Interviewed him in a perfectly professional manner, John?
Behave yourself, stop. Do you know, actually, there's one thing I did want to say. So on the Thursday, I was at a wedding. So I listened to a lot of it on Five Live and then watched the BBC feed on the Thursday night. What was interesting was, is that in order to fill as much time, they get some really good guests and they get some really spiky interviews on Five Live, way more spiky than anything Tim Barter would do on television. And so, you know, so if a player comes off, like, they were really quite spiky about Rory. And they also had a very interesting long interview with Craig Connolly, I think it is. It's Brandon Grace's caddy. He's fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's an unbelievably interesting guy.
Yeah.
And has so much to say. Like, that's exactly what I was. We absolutely need to.
I have his number. I met him at the Ryder Cup and he gave me his number and he said he'd come on the show.
Let's
and
talk.
In typical production of Golf Weekly way, I've never texted him back.
Pass it on to our producer there, Nathan.
Yeah.
Let's talk Rory. This tournament obviously finished in the most unbelievable fashion, and then because of Rory on the first, it began in the most dramatic fashion imaginable. He walked off the first green out of contention. It was just the most inconceivable thing. He's been thinking about this shot for 4 years, since 2015 when this thing was whole announced. He's at Memphis. He's just moved into his new house in Florida. He hasn't picked up a club, he was saying yesterday. Nathan tweeted this press conference, if you want to have a look at it. We're going to play a clip of it now. He hadn't picked up his clubs from Friday when he finished up at Portrush until yesterday. So he's at Memphis. He's playing with Koepka and Jason Day. This is very interesting from McIlroy, I think. He's talking about what happened on the first. Absolutely fascinating. Because he had mentioned that he had went out OB right on the Wednesday in practice. But he talks more about how, and you'll hear here, suddenly gripped by nerves at the moment he was almost announced on tee. But first of all, and this is also, I think, quite striking and genuine as well, how in a perverse way the emotion on Friday made it an incredibly intense and actually almost a positive experience. So here's McIlroy in Memphis.
I don't know if it hit home my place in the game, but I think it was more where I stood in terms of to the people of my home country. I think that was what was overwhelming for me. It wasn't the fact I didn't cry because I missed a cut. I was overwhelmed by the support that I got, and I guess at the end of the day, I didn't think I meant as much to them, and I realized that they mean more to me than I thought they did. So I think it went both ways. And it was really nice. I mean, I probably had to stop myself from crying about four times on the back nine, not because of the situation I found myself in, but just because of the support. You know, it sounded like Sunday in terms of trying to win the golf tournament. And so, you know, I just sort of had to take a step back and be like, wow, I sort of mean a lot to these people, and that felt really good, you know, in fairness. And selfishly, I said this afterwards, I would have loved to have played in that atmosphere for two more days. But it's such a weird thing to say, but, you know, to think about a missed cut being one of the best experiences you've ever had on a golf course. But I guess there is some sort of silver lining in there somewhere. I think I've learned a lot in the four majors this year in terms of how I've started, how I've played in them, how I've tried to approach them. I almost tried to downplay the majors this year, try to treat them like every other event, and I've realized they're not like every other event. You need to have a certain mindset. You need to prepare differently, and I tried a sort of different strategy this year. It didn't quite work for me, and just have to reassess that going forward.
Rory, has there ever been a time in your career when you've had to stop yourself from crying during a round of golf?
No. And it just shows you, I mean, sometimes I try to take the emotion out of playing golf. You know, I try to think logically and try to be very stoic about the whole thing. But I was emotional on Friday and I was still able to play good golf in spite of that. So I thought that was a good lesson as well, that you know, sometimes a bit of emotion on the course isn't a bad thing. And it's just about how you can handle it and resetting in between shots. And, you know, it was really the standing ovations that I was getting walking on the greens, and then from walking from greens to tees, that's when it really hit me, you know. So I at least had a little bit of time to gather myself and get ready for the next shot.
And going back to Thursday, just starting the round, were you a little surprised by the emotions that you had?
So it's so funny. I was so relaxed in the warm-up. I was so relaxed on the putting green 10 minutes before. And once I was announced and I put my tee in the ground, I sort of noticed my hand trembling. And I was like, geez, this is different. And I don't know, first tee shot there wasn't really a comfortable tee shot for me anyway last week. And, you know, in hindsight, I probably should have just hit driver. You know, instead of trying to hit an iron down there and trying to, should have probably just freewheeled with driver. And I think subconsciously I knew I was uncomfortable because I suggested a different club to Harry. You know, and he said, well, this is the club we've hit every day in practice and it's done well. Like, why would you want to hit something different? And I'm like, well, I don't know. But, yeah, I was surprised at how nervous I was, but it came on so rapidly. I think that was the thing that was different about it. It wasn't like this build up during the warm up or, you know, I was totally fine. And then as once my name was announced, it was like, oh, this is a little different. Sort of weird, but anyways.
Rory McIlroy, there's a lot in that.
Yeah, it sort of sums up everything that's great about McIlroy, but also everything that's wrong with Rory McIlroy right now.
Yeah.
So honest, brilliantly honest. But has he just put a rod through his own back for the next 8-9 months? Like, he's essentially admitted, you could say, that he bottled it.
Mm.
That he stood up in the first tee and the nerves got the better of him. That the occasion was too much. The next 8 months are, unfortunately for him, going to be building up to Augusta. Well, Rory, if you're leading into the final round, remember what happened at Portrush? How can you be sure it's not going to happen again? And also, it sort of makes you think, can we spend 8 months, well, no, we're only 6 months with the way the new calendar goes, 6 months in of listening to Rory doing press conferences about his positive state of mind and is reading all these self-help books and seems to be indulging and engaging in a little bit of psychology at the moment, that he still went to an Open Championship in his home country, and that was the first time he thought, ooh, I might be a little bit nervous here, this might be slightly different. Like, should he not have been expecting this? Should he not have been mentally prepared that this is going to be different to anything that's gone before?
It is in complete contrast to how Larry seems to have been feeling. Now, look, this is how things finish dictate, you know, who approached things better and who didn't. But Larry seemed to engage with his nerves and have to be up at 6:30 and go for walks with Neil Manship and talk to him the night before. And McIlroy seems to have suddenly been hit with this wave, this absolute crushing wave, the moment he almost engaged with the reality of what was happening. It seemed to me like in his warm-up, if he's hitting it that well and he was blasting it down the range and he was on TV and then suddenly he's on the tee, like, is he practicing visualization? Is he imagining that moment? Is he going through that moment in full technicolor, which is what you have to do? It's recommended practice now. This is not airy-fairy stuff. It will insulate you from that sudden attack of nerves, which in golf you have to insulate yourself against. Is he visualizing that moment enough? GA teams stand for a national anthem and fake it all and train a few days before a match. There is a reason they do it. They're not doing it for the crack. There's a lot of cynical people in GAA camps who still understand the value of it. Did McIlroy stand up in a tee for 6 weeks beforehand and get a tee announcer and play crowd noise to get him in a certain space and visualise it? You know, it's just, like, it'd break your heart. I agree, it gets all that's great about him. But then there's also, as with too much of McIlroy's stuff, he's saying things that just don't ring true or are completely diametrically opposed to what he was saying just a week before. So, like, he's sitting there with Nick Doherty at the Scottish Open on tape saying, if I win at Portrush, this will be the pinnacle of my career. This will beat anything I've ever done and anything I will do.
Mm.
And he knows Grand Slam's around the corner potentially. This will be the pinnacle. And I'm not going to the Irish Open because I want to get perfect preparation for Portrush. But then he's also saying, I tried to play the majors down this year.
Like, which is it? Is it like the greatest thing you'll ever do in your life ever? Or is it I'm just playing it down, it's just another tournament? I don't know. Is
every, paper on the Wednesday was McIlroy, I'll be in tears if I lift the claret jug at Portrush. So clearly you had sort of visualised what it would be like and what it would mean to people if you could win an Open Championship. Now, Graham McDowell also said when he stood up in the first on Thursday morning, he got a bit teary and was surprised by it.
Yeah.
So maybe you can't fake that until you get there. But it does just feel that he had a late tea time on the Thursday. You surely, when you arrive, you get a sense of the atmosphere. And
it was morning-ish, or like midday, 11, 12 kind of territory. Because I was listening to it in the car driving up.
I remember thinking, Friday he was out late. Yeah. Sorry, he was out earlier. But do you not just get a sense from the range and the buzz around the putting green that...
No, it's very striking. Fiona, I'll bring you in here. Just one last point, an overarching point I want to make. And again, I emphasise, he is so fascinating because he's so open. And it's brilliant. But I think someone needs to get a hold of him now and say, we have to acknowledge there is a problem. What you did on the first tee was not normal. You're learning too slowly here. Like, that is the brutal point you would have to make to him. Saying to Harry Diamond, should we change club? Last minute, when you know this tee shot better than the back of your hand, you've hit it hundreds of times, maybe thousands of times, you've visualised it, to suddenly, in that moment, be that unsure of the strategy or the right thing to do. I don't care if a week before you say, screw it, we're hitting driver no matter what, we're aiming at that middle cut of the fairway and we're going driver, it's my best club and we're going to be aggressive. That's fine, but to be that rattled on the tee is really, really worrying because he's so experienced. What is he, 30 years of age now?
Yep.
There's nothing left for him to learn about preparing for majors. He's won four of them. And my main thought during that whole brilliant press conference he gave was, Brooks Koepka, Brooks Koepka, Brooks Koepka. You know, do I play the majors up? Do I play the majors down? Am I nervous? Am I not nervous? Do I arrive the Monday before a tournament or the Wednesday before a tournament? Do I read self-help books or do I go and see a sports psychologist? Do I go for a run the night before? Do I not go? It doesn't matter to Brooks. Like, it doesn't matter. Brooks just rocking up and he's finding a way to play, and McIlroy needs to stop obsessing, I feel, over getting the absolute perfect preparation. I did this before congressional, so I have to do this now. I did it. Just, you've just got to kind of cut through the lack of kind of resilience a little bit. And even if you're like feeling crap and you've got a sore wrist and you haven't slept for 3 nights and you're nervous as hell, just when you rock up on the first tee, like,
be sure of yourself.
As JP had to say to him on the 6th at the Open a couple of years ago, you're Rory fucking McIlroy. Like, just quit all the bullshit and all the nonsense. You're Rory McIlroy. Here we are at 30, and he's saying things like, I've learned a lot about how to prepare for the majors this year. Part of me thinks, wow, fascinating mind. Another part of me is very worried for him.
There's, you're right. I mean, you're both right. And there's a lot in that interview. I think things that are diametrically opposed to each other. So the positive is that his attempted comeback on the Friday was so exhilarating and so exciting and so electric, and to fall short so barely just adds to the Rory McIlroy story, and it just contributes to his global superstardom in the world of golf. I think that it'll add to his persona. It'll make him a greater brand. I think I actually think his failure at Portrush and the manner in which he tried to battle it is actually an amazing story, and he played so well and all the rest of it. So that's the good.
Yeah, agree with all that, by the way.
The bad, I mean, without necessarily covering the same ground that you guys have covered, I thought all that stuff about, I turned to Harry and asked him, I was like, I thought that was horseshit. It's like, what are you talking about? Like, everyone else went with iron. You guys have been practicing with iron. First of all, does that it raises questions about what are you doing talking about changing club? But more to the point, what's Harry Diamond doing not going, Rory, are you mental?
I think Diamond did do that. So that is why they hit the planned club, because in fairness, Diamond must have said, no, this is our plan.
But also, as well, as I've heard like three different versions of the story from Rory McIlroy, because the day after he says that, well, the reason I obviously subconsciously went a little left, because as you said, Joe, he went out OB right on the Wednesday in the practice round. And even by Rory's own admission, it wasn't that bad a shot. It probably got penalised a lot worse than the shot deserved. if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
But that's not the issue. I mean, of course, that was a terrible way to start, and he has to deal with nerves, etc. It's the 16th that was the issue. The three put on 16 is the biggest four fire alarm. Like, to miss the putt and then to go over and petulantly go over and just kind of wrap it in and miss that. And it's and even in fairness, Rory himself said it on the day. He goes, it's not the OB on one that's really bothering me. That can happen, because he followed that by playing some pretty solid golf.
Mm. I sort of disagree on that. I do think you're dead right on what happened at 16 was sort of unacceptable.
He used the word inexcusable.
For a player of his stature
absolutely.
To be that petulant and just sort of throw a putter at it is pretty unacceptable. But I think it suited him on Thursday night to get that out there to move on from what happened on the first. Because clearly, listening to him yesterday, what happened at the first wasn't just out of bounds, was in a peculiar position for the opening tee shot of a major championship, probably the toughest opening tee shot to a major championship there's been. He's actually admitted since that the nerves got the better of him, which he didn't want to talk about on Thursday night or Friday night. Mm. He wanted to get out of Dodge and give himself a bit of space. So it was suited him to say, oh yeah, 16 was a bigger one. Actually, you know, the first kind of calmed me down because I thought things can't get much worse. Yeah. I do agree with you that I think in Brand McIlroy, the human side of things, what happened on Friday, you couldn't but feel sorry for him when he was doing the interview with Tim Barter and he's welling up.
Yeah.
But also, I think for people who watch golf all the time, they'll move on quickly from that and go, Friday's round was pointless. We all knew it was coming. It was brilliant. I was about to leave the course and then I thought, I haven't seen a shot of McIlroy yet. I'm going to go out. And followed him 16, 17, 18. And it was bizarre. It was, wait a second, it was almost as if actually other people had left and everyone started going, oh, we got to see this. It might happen. And if he'd holed out right at the very end and got the birdie, the place would have just gone absolutely wild. But ultimately, he was still never going to win the tournament. So it was proof again that when there's nothing going on up here, when it's just aggressive golf, going out enjoying himself like he was when he was 16 or when he was 20, there's nobody better. But he's Rory McIlroy, so he doesn't get to play that type of golf. There's always going to be pressure.
But Nathan, okay, I take your point. But here's, by way of example, the greatest player of all time is notoriously bad off the first tee on Thursday. Tiger Woods, always, if you go back statistically, never really hits that good a shot for whatever reason. And I know that Hank Haney in the book said that he does suffer from nerves. But the difference between Tiger and Rory is that Tiger can move on from that crappy shot and just grind and just work hard. Rory doesn't. Now, he works hard for a while and then doesn't. And so there is a process issue, I think. Now, I realise that Rory McIlroy's never sat down with me and confided in me as to what goes on with him. So all of this is conjecture and speculation. But it seems to me is that you have a player who, who is not, who operates as a natural golfer, where everything in his sphere is designed to help him access his natural genius, which nobody denies he has. But he doesn't deal with pressure particularly well, which is why he backs into a Sunday top 10 a lot of the times and hasn't really performed in majors for 5 years, whilst at the same time winning twice this year. And Nathan, you weren't on the pod when Joe and I looked at this. But, this year he has statistically, he's having the fourth best season of any golfer since 2004 in terms of strokes gained. So these two converging truths, he doesn't perform well under extreme pressure. He hasn't performed well under extreme pressure over the last 5 years. But at the same time, he is playing golf that 144 other guys, with the exception of Brooks Koepka, would envy over the course of this 2019 season. And it seems to me this is the confounding truth that is Rory McIlroy. He's playing brilliant, brilliant golf. And yet, he did on Friday. And yet, when push comes to shove, something is happening. I have his opening rounds in majors aren't that bad over the last 2 years. 69, 80, 69, 70, 73, 72, 68, and 79. So last year at the US Open when he shot the 80, but so did Spieth and Dustin Johnson, and obviously this year at Portrush. But otherwise, like, he's playing some good stuff. So
can you actually say that? Can you say he's playing brilliant golf when in the only tournaments that matter to him, he's not? Well done, you've won the Canadian Open. Nobody cares.
But you'd have to say the players matters to him, you know.
He won the players.
Yeah,
no, but Nathan,
I guess he won the players. I fully understand statistically he's having this unbelievable season. But his entire season is focused around four tournaments. And in those tournaments, he hasn't played well.
He just said here he tried to downplay the majors, though.
Next week he's going to say
I'll be defined by the majors.
Yeah.
He's playing this amazing golf and yet cannot play under pressure.
So these
contradictory truths are Rory McIlroy. Mm. Now, and I say this advisedly because, as I said, Rory is not confiding in me. He's not telling me how he feels about things. So, I mean, we all know, like, golfers talk an awful lot of shite about an awful lot of things, and that's fine. They're entitled to it if they want. I'm going to downplay the majors. You're not really downplaying the majors. You might be. So it goes back to the question I asked Neil Manship. Is Rory have the ability to acknowledge the truth that the major is unlike the players or, you know, the Canadian Open or whatever? But at the same time, by acknowledging the truth, being able to be as relaxed as he possibly can. Is he working on that aspect of his game? You know, that mental side, because like the 16th is connected to the first. The 18th is connected to the 16th on the Thursday. I'm absolutely convinced of it. I'm convinced that what we saw on the 16th, that petulant tap-in, is because he hasn't moved on from the quadruple bogey of the first. Now, for a professional golfer who is at the very, very top of his game, that is, what's the word? Is it inexcusable? Is that the word they're using?
He used that word, yeah.
Yeah, it's inexcusable. It's absolutely inexcusable. And yet, for his brand, brand Rory has been enriched by this experience.
Another interesting tangent to this discussion which has cropped up is the place of golf in McIlroy's life. You know, there were pieces at the weekend. We did the paper review here and several people, Andy Dunn even, who's a very reasoned, good guy, former rugby player, does punditry with us, was saying he would love Roy to get obsessive about it, to become fearsome, for this to become like, you know, just the everything in his life, for him to come out on Thursday and Friday and instead of speaking very brilliantly to the media, to be petulant and angry and fuming with himself, uncontrolled rage at himself. You know, he wants that fire because he feels like that's what, you know, if you're a real champion, that's what you should have. And there is a logic to that. But then by the same token, the guy who's won the tournament has said the reason that he's won the tournament is that 3 years ago in Oakmont, a very similar golfer, he said, I'm a very similar golfer, but my life's in a different place. The perspective, the grounding that having a daughter and having a wife and a family life has given me has put golf a little bit in perspective, and that makes it easier. So again, that's why I come back to this Brooks Koepka point. Whether Brooks Koepka has 10 kids or no kids, whether Brooks Koepka is married or not married, whether golf to him is everything or nothing, it all works. You just have to find a way to make it work. I don't know what's going on here. It doesn't seem McIlroy engages in any professional sports psychology. Brad Faxon is a disciple of Bob Rotella, so McGinley often wonders if McIlroy is getting nuggets, Rotella nuggets, through Faxon, and maybe that's helping, maybe it's not. Like, we don't know what's going on here, but certainly he's given us enough there to talk about the first tee, and certainly that the story of that first tee, you have to say, is someone who's just unprepared mentally to take on the major at Portrush. That is just completely inarguable.
Clearly, he's never going to be Brooks Koepka. But you wouldn't be in any way surprised that Rory McIlroy that Andy Dunn is talking about, if that Rory McIlroy does emerge. So he has a child over the next couple of years. That could go the opposite way to Shane Lowry. It could be, actually, do you know what? I want my child to see the legacy.
Maybe
I want to go out there and actually, you know what, I've just realized, you know, I don't want my child to think, oh, why were you good when you're 20s and what happened for the next 15 years of your career? Yeah. I want to go out and prove a point.
Tiger Woods. I'm going to put forward a theory. You can agree or disagree. I think this is going to be the making of Rory McIlroy. I think this, the next 230 odd days, I think this has been such a kick up the ass to him. I think this has been a wake up call for him in a massive way. And I would be very confident he's going to re-emerge next year and win a major.
We'll see.
Yeah, I am tempted to agree. Sorry.
No, go on, Nathan.
I'm tempted to I'm tempted to agree in that I think this was an unbelievable shock to his system.
Yeah.
That it went so horribly, horribly wrong. I just worry that it's such a long build-up and that I sort of felt before this year's Masters, even though he was playing well, that, and he was saying all the right things, that everything he was saying was all a load of bollocks because we weren't going to know till he got... And that's, I think that is... It's the worst... The biggest issue he has is that the one he's wanting to win is the Masters, mm-hmm. and that he needs to win is the Masters. And there's this endless build-up. And we can't believe anything that happens between... He could go, and I wouldn't be at all surprised if he wins the World Golf Championship this week and wins three or four more times. None of it is going to matter if he doesn't perform at Augusta. And we're going to spend countless podcasts talking about it. But still, every single conversation, and you could be here in February and he's won three times already, and you're like, you know, I really feel actually that was a turning point. And then he turns up and he has his usual Masters, and everyone goes...
Same old story.
Mentally, same old story. And like, does that weigh on him as well?
I agree with you, Nathan. And I disagree with Andy Dunn because I think that unlike Shane Lowry, or I dare I say even Brooks Koepka, Rory McIlroy was removed from normal childhood at the age of 10 and hasn't had a normal life, has been a prodigy in the Goldfish Bowl. And it seems to me, judging from afar, that the last few years have been Rory McIlroy, unlike a Tiger Woods or unlike the other great automatons of sport, trying to carve out a sense of normalcy for himself. You know, living life with his friends. I go to Man United matches. I go shark fishing or whatever the hell he likes to do. You know, to live, to enjoy the fruits of his remarkable talent. And that these things, I mean, in order to become, in order to chase tournament greatness, you make these enormous sacrifices, which I suspect that Rory battles with perhaps a little more than Tiger Woods did in his pomp. I mean, it's all well and good for Tiger Woods at 42 to go, oh, I just want to spend more time with my family. And you're like, whatever. But also as well, and I realize that we're living in the kind of the age of Brooks Koepka. Like, these last 2 years have been very much the Brooks Koepka years. But, you know, we'll see how long that lasts as well. Like, you know, I mean, Koepka really needs to win some PGA tournaments. Like, you know, like there's something...
Does he?
Finish top four in every major this year?
Does he really?
Yeah, no.
I don't think he does.
No, but I'm saying this is that true greatness. Like, true greatness, if you look at Jack Nicklaus, Tiger Woods, true greatness is winning consistently. You know, there's something of the Paris Saint-Germain about, it's a bad example because Paris Saint-Germain don't win anything. But I'm not taking away from Brooks Koepka.
Are Paris Saint-Germain who beat all the little guys and then fail on the big stage, not the complete opposite of Brooks
It's the Koepka. Real Madrid. Apologies. Yeah. It's Real
Koepka's
Madrid.
Real Madrid, Rory's Paris Saint-Germain. That's what we got here.
Well,
Shane Lowry's Liverpool.
Shane Lowry's Liverpool. No, but we're okay, Man so United. Real Madrid. And I'm hardly going to pick on the most dominant golfer of the last 24 months by a country mile, who in the last 2 years has been 22 shots ahead of the field in all eight majors.
Yeah.
Like, that's an extraordinary, like, accomplishment. Sorry. So no disrespect to Brooks Koepka. But I think the thing with Rory is this idea of like, oh, I want to see him. Like, maybe he will, but maybe he won't. Mm. And maybe what he'll do, he'll go, you know what? I've got four majors. Maybe I'll add a couple more. Maybe I won't. But, you know, but in the meantime, like, you know, I'm going to live a pretty normal life. I'm with my wife. We might have some kids. We'll start a family. I'll have some good friends. I've got lots of money. I'm going to have other business interests. I'm going to try and then, one final thing is that I fear that his tears, his shock, his sense of pleasant surprise that he had in Portrush, I think will fade. I mean, Rory McIlroy outgrew Northern Ireland a long time ago. And as much as he was reminded of the passion and the fire and the sheer amazing joy of being playing in front of your homegrown fans, absolutely. The truth is that, as Nathan pointed out, Rory McIlroy's true ambition is to win the Masters. And he lives in Florida. And, you know, he's a global brand. He's a big guy. He'll move on from this, I think. And like Nathan said, I fear that, you know, he'll come again. Maybe if he doesn't do something fundamental to his process, I think he'll hit the tee In early April next year, and we'll be asking again. It's just like, well, you know, I should have, you know, I learned an awful lot this week, and yeah. You know, same old, same old.
Okay, deep breaths all round. We're going to move on. My final point is, he spoke so well on the Thursday, and I know people use this as a stick to beat him with as well. And go, Ollie Holt of the Mirror wrote back when I said, "Geez, Rory spoke very well there," and said, "Pity he didn't play well or something like that."
Yeah, which you is. Know.
And I was like, well, look, we can compartmentalise them. He was brilliant, and I thought he was very classy. And my heart sank on Thursday when that happened.
Oh,
I just thought...
It was horrendous.
You're kidding me.
He does provide that contradiction for journalists, sports journalists all the time.
Yeah.
That a large part of you watch them going, just stop talking. Stop doing press conferences for the next 6 months,
yeah. Please.
But then he's so interesting yeah. Every single time he does talk.
So, look, he's in Memphis, WGC... The golf season is crap, by the way. I'm not ready for a WGC. It's just terrible. Like, we just should not be into a WGC this week. McIlroy gets underway with Koepka. Oh, jeez. All the talk of Koepka.
Yeah.
McIlroy and Koepka.
Can I mention one thing on Koepka? And I went to his press briefings where he stands up much higher than you. You were probably in the little booth.
Yeah.
God, he's an impressive specimen of a man. And just the general disdain he looked at me and all the rest of the media with, I couldn't help but admire him. I was like, you're dead right.
Yeah.
As everyone was trying to... I do feel sorry for him with some of the... Just the line of questioning from some of the journalists, which was, Brooks, you're obviously right in contention. Tommy Fleetwood's doing a press conference and, you know, there's only five of us here.
Stop.
Talking to you.
The chip on the shoulder stuff?
Yeah. And, you know, do you feel that, you know, even again this week, you know, people are ignoring you because there's only five of us here interviewing Tommy Fleetwood's into the press conference.
Jeez, really?
Yeah, and Koepka's like, well, he's leading the tournament. So, he said, but, you know, you're right there and you're the major winner. You know, Tommy's never won a major. Yeah, but he's leading the tournament. And, you know, if I was leading the tournament, I'd be in there. But yeah. I'm not, so I'm out here with you.
Yeah.
So,
jeez, they love that narrative now.
Oh, it's the only thing.
That's all
they
want.
Kept coming up. He was impressive. But the one thing I would say about Koepka this season, so obviously he's had this unbelievable major championship season.
He's the Real Madrid of...
But we would give... He's certainly not the Paris Saint-Germain. with the amount of stick we give Rory, or we used to give Rory, which was... About 3 years ago, a storyline about what was going wrong for Rory was that he didn't practice enough.
Yeah.
So Koepka now, at both the Open Championship and at Pebble Beach, tee to green has been unbelievable.
Yeah.
Couldn't putt. So on Friday, he said, he made the comment of, I'm hitting the ball better than anybody, and then statistically it proved he wasn't, but he couldn't hold a putt.
Yeah.
Is he practicing enough?
Good question.
Like, is he, if he doesn't pick up a club from one tournament to another, everybody knows you're going to a links tournament, that the greens are going to be a lot slower. Like, has he spent enough time there? Is he ready for this? Mm-hmm. It is a major championship. Has he prepared himself correctly on the greens? Exact same statistics, I think, at Pebble Beach. After two rounds, everybody was waiting. Well, when he gets it together on the greens, it's over.
Mm.
But he never did.
Mm.
So that's two majors in a row where his putting has let him down.
Mm. Fair question. I wonder as well. He wears it as a badge of honour almost how little he practices. Anyway, Memphis, McIlroy, Koepka, Jason Day, TPC Southwind, the St. Jude Invitational. Phil Mickelson is there. He has turned up. There was some doubt. It feels like a long time ago since he won, but he won this season. You keep forgetting. So since he won at the Pebble Beach Pro-Am, his highest finish since February, 18th in the Masters in April, he said, I thought after winning Pebble I was going to have a phenomenal year. Last 4 months have been surprisingly difficult. He's not in good shape. Brooks Koepka is the favourite, 8-1. Dustin Johnson, second favourite, 8-1. McIlroy, 9-1. John Rahm, bit of a disappointment last week, 11s. Justin Thomas said he's going to win very soon, is at 14s. Cantley, 18s. And Xander Schauffele.
Cheat!
20-1. Tied for 41st, Portrush. So they tested 30 drivers. I saw them doing this, actually. I knew they had tested Tiger's driver because I saw this on Thursday at the range where, and we haven't even talked about Tiger. Isn't that a sad indictment? So I saw them even take note of Tiger's driver. And so I figured, oh, he's... Because he turned around to the... She was in her kind of early 20s and he said, yeah, look, whatever you need to do, do it, no problem. But they tested 30 of the drivers. 30 samples were taken last week. Without getting too technical, they're testing the trampoline effect almost on drivers.
Mm.
So the Schauffele driver failed a CT test, as in a characteristic time, which uses a pendulum to measure the amount of microseconds a metal ball is in contact with the face when it's swung against it. Schauffele flipped out and initially said the RNA had screwed him over.
Since then, he said, I don't think the RNA leaked the information. The fact is it was leaked some way or another to caddies or other players on the range. During the testing time, the door was wide open. I don't know how it happened, but their intentions were not to ruin a player. Earlier on, he had accused the governing body of trying to ruin his image by allowing the news to come out. I cleared the whole cheating thing up. Me being called a cheater by another player, that got cleared up. I'm cool with everyone out here. At no point in any sport do you want to be known as a cheater. I've decided to take a stance for my own integrity. So that's Schauffele. It's an interesting one. I think there were rumours that several other drivers out of the 30 had failed.
Well, he said it.
Yeah. If he's right, though, it would suggest that even if one out of 30 has failed, they probably need to start testing all of them. Or I think Koepka suggested anyone who finishes in the top 5 or top 10, all their equipment is tested. Mm. Kind of interesting that... what kind of driver was it? Was it Callaway?
His was the Callaway.
His was the Callaway. So, like, what are they doing?
Well, this is what I was wondering about the accusations of cheating. How involved are the players in the science of their driver?
I checked this out. As with everything, there is a cross-section. There are those who wander in, let's say the Dustin Johnson types. Give me my bat, please.
Yeah.
I like white. There are those who wander in and say, just give it to me. Whatever, put it in the bag, done, don't care, bang, I'll play with anything, don't matter.
And they just want to hit them until they find one that they like.
And then there are those who understand the science and the specs and are very, very involved. I don't know where Xander Schauffele is on the spectrum. And to be fair, Dustin Johnson gets a hard time. He may well be very involved in all the specs because I'm sure he has big golf IQ. We don't know, but there's a cross-section, I've been reliably told.
But also as well as I was reading all of the same stuff as well, that wear and tear can affect the CT so that the slightly older driver can easily cross into illegal without you knowing. So I'm working on the premise that nobody knows that. I thought what was interesting was is that, I mean, clearly he blamed the RNA first. He took them to task and then had to backtrack. Now, he was probably given some very sound advice. It's like, you've got to make right here.
Yeah.
You've got to make this right because you're talking, you're letting anger dictate you. However, one thing I kind of respect about him is that he's very, very aware of not being branded a cheater, you know? And, I thought it was a bit of a storm in a teacup, but like only made into a proper farrago by Xander himself. Robert McIntyre. I thought that this was interesting. You followed this, didn't you?
I certainly did. About Chevy Ford. Did you not follow this?
He took someone to task, didn't
he? Kyle Stanley.
Kyle
Stanley hit a drive and it hit Robert McIntyre's caddy's mother. In the crowd.
Yeah.
It hit her. And afterwards, Robert McIntyre was furious at Kyle Stanley for not shouting four, to which Kyle Stanley very calmly replied. He goes, yeah, a lot of people shouted four, you know, like, what's the big thing?
Yeah.
And to which I say, yes, shout four. Just shout four.
I'm going to put my hand up and say, I've been on a tee box before and routinely thumped one way right. And if like 2-3 of my partners have all screamed four, I have not, you know. Now, generally I do scream four. But the thing that kind of struck me as a bit mad is in the post Brooks Koepka Le Golf National blinding a woman era. Why? Like, you just have to be seen to do it.
That's exactly. That's what I mean. I absolutely take Kyle Stanley on his word. It's just like loads of people shouted four.
Yeah.
It's like Robert McIntyre's caddy's mother doesn't need to hear me shout four to duck. So long as she hears a four shout, she should duck, and that's fine.
Yeah.
But you're absolutely correct. In the post Golf National era, it behooves each player who hits the shot to take personal responsibility and just at least join in the chorus of four shouts.
Yeah.
We need more behooving from Fionn.
Yeah, behooves is a great word, Fionn.
Yeah.
And you said it with real oomph.
I just think, and whilst I think Robert McIntyre's anger was misdirected and misplaced, I think he had no business getting that tick with Kyle Stanley. I do think that Kyle Stanley would avoid any anybody talking, you know, like about his responsibilities if he just said, yeah, four, you know, just even if you do, you don't even have to shout that loud. Just enough for the guys in the tee box to hear you.
Yeah.
Shout it forward. What do you want?
Well, quite often you're just spreading the word. You know, you say four, then they see loads of arms pointing and then it spreads up the field. You're That's not it. Expected to be heard 300 yards away necessarily.
Yeah, if it's still happening after what happened with Brooks Koepka, it's never going to end. Like, and it is just part of the game.
Did Rory shout four?
Well, one of the surprising things with Rory going out of bounds was that it didn't hit a load of people and bounce back inbounds.
Yeah, I know.
You would have sort of assumed that there'd be so many people down there.
Broke a woman's mobile phone. Mm. Here's a genuine question in this very sad era where we love our phones so much. Would you rather, Fionn, if you were there on the first near that woman, would you rather take that golf ball from Rory McIlroy in the neck, your bare neck, or would you rather McIlroy had smashed your phone to pieces?
That's a great
what
question.
Kind of damage? No, this is a good question.
That's a good question.
What damage am I taking in the neck, though?
You don't get to decide in advance. The ball is in the air. You get to press
take
pause.
Take the phone in that case.
You get to press pause. And all you know is it's going to hit you on the side of the neck. It's
not
going to
hold your phone up and get a direct hit.
It's not going to hit your Adam's apple. But what you do know for sure is it is going to destroy your phone beyond all reasonable
I would
doubt.
Definitely move. I would definitely protect my phone with my body. 100%.
I think I'd take it in the neck as well.
Yeah. Nathan?
I'd take my chances.
Oh, not in the neck. No,
okay, where would you take my
neck? Anywhere else.
Not here.
Below the neck. But anywhere below the neck, I'm taking it.
I'm sure.
You're wearing
That's
clothes below
fair.
The neck. We need bare skin.
It's like Shane Lowry hit somebody on... Like it's gone down. It's become so common. Mm. Like, was it not... You should not get a glove and 100 quid inside the glove. Whereas now it seems you just get the glove.
Barely a thank
so
you.
So Lowry hit somebody on Sunday. Yeah. On the, I think the back of the neck, potentially.
Who's carrying 100 quid?
Yeah, Phil Mickelson.
Phil Mickelson. Which we'll come
100
to
quid everywhere.
Yeah.
And you get a signed glove saying, sorry, !!
So you genuinely telling me, your phone there, your lifeline to Twitter, you're at this golf tournament, there's a lot going on, you want to be in contact, you want to be tweeting, you want to be doing stuff.
I'm not getting hit in the neck by a ball from...
I just don't think you've thought through the hassle of having to go to your phone shop. You find out, oh, geez, my insurance doesn't cover me for this.
Does McIlroy buy that woman a new phone?
McIlroy will buy them a new phone.
Does he? That's what I'm wondering.
Your SIM card's also been destroyed. You're going to be without your phone for a week.
But I'm actually genuinely wondering now. Does McIlroy buy her a new phone?
If she's not rocking an iPhone 10, something's going to ride there.
Absolutely.
What phone was it, said Rory? iPhone 10.
iPhone 10X. Yeah.
It doesn't look like it at all when it's smashed to pieces. It doesn't look anything like it looked like before you hit it. It looks like an old Nokia. No.
At Golf Weekly OTB poll about to start.
Yeah.
One in the neck. It's only an iron. It's not like he's
hit that's true. If he hit driver, it would have been a totally different story.
But is it on the
would you
is it on the way up or in the arc?
Shot at the first to hit you in the neck or your mobile phone.
Here's a question for you.
I've got to go and do
sorry,
some work
no, just
stage.
About mobile phones.
This podcast is out of control lengthwise. We got to...
Yeah.
I don't know if we can afford a mobile phone conversation much further.
No. It's just Nathan, did you notice that the Wi-Fi was rubbish up there?
Did I notice that the Wi-Fi was rubbish? A little bit. But, like, you're out in the middle of a golf course. But the media Wi-Fi, I think, is slightly different.
Oh, they were complaining that because you can't buy the little radios anymore, so you have to have the app on your phone if you want to listen to the commentary. But, like, the phones kept freezing. The app kept freezing because the signal was... just the contention rates were just... Obviously, they had like 237,000 people there.
Do you know what we should compliment the Open about and the Irish Open? Because... Actually, not the Irish Open, because we mentioned this and you brought this up when we were wandering Lahinch. The amount of plastic bottles that were there.
Terrible.
Absolutely terrible. So the very next week, obviously overhearing our conversation going around Lahinch, no more plastic bottles. And in Portrush, no plastic bottles. So you had to buy or bring your own bottle... Or buy, and all the media got a free little...
canister thing.
Canister, silver canister thing. And you just got free fill-ups.
Now that was good.
And there wasn't... the difference, I would say, that makes it a clean-up operation afterwards.
Yeah. I would suggest, though, that the players, when they get their water, they crack open a can of water and pour it into their canister.
Yeah.
Is metal that much better for the environment?
Yeah, because you can recycle metal.
You can recycle plastic as well.
But maybe... Yeah. Maybe it's a lot easier.
I was like, why don't they have some kind of fountain at each... teabox.
But you... Yeah.
I just really like that. Cracking open a can of water. Anyway, we really have to move on because people have to get on with their day. Adair Manor is going to host the Ryder Cup in 2026. look, the good news just keeps coming for Irish golf at the moment. What can we say, international listeners? We're just the best. 20 years on from the K Club. So in Paris, they had an attendance of 270,000. Beats the Open in Portrush. So that is coming to Adair. The Belfry, which also had a big upgrade, was in contention. It's going to bring 90 to 160 million to the Irish economy. So it's Whistling Straits in Wisconsin. It'll go to Rome in 2022, back to the States. And then 2026, Adair Manor. That's going to be fantastic. We'll talk about that in due course. And we have an Adair Manor course review experience coming your way. We were down there a couple of weeks ago.
We went down to do some research ahead of this.
We obviously got the phone call early. We got the heads up. We knew this was coming.
Yeah.
So that's amazing. And then I should mention the Evian Championship. It'll be on your TV screens. I was watching some of this morning over in France. Jeez, it's hot in France. Talking of plastic bottles, the world is ending. So the LPGA, not thrilled because they're playing four majors in 10 weeks. Four majors in 10 weeks. And they're going back to back. So they have the Evian Championship this week and then they have the British Open next week. Not ideal. First time since 1960 the women's majors have been played in back-to-back weeks. The women's game's in a strange place at the moment. The last 11 majors have been won by 11 different players. That is where the women's game is at. Nobody's won two majors in a single year since Imbie Park did it 4 years ago. So they're waiting for a dominant force to emerge in the women's game. Any very final thoughts anyone wants to bring? We got Memphis. I'm not quite ready for WGC, but I reckon come this evening, actually, the more I think about it, I can live with it.
I think I'm in such a good golf zone right now.
Yeah.
The chances is down and watch Koepka and Rory.
Yeah. Koepka and Rory.
I'll be getting annoyed no matter what happens.
Yeah.
The only thing, I watched Phil's Farside Chat. I bored the bejesus out of me.
I won't mention that I recorded the audio in and was going to play it.
Oh, okay.
No, well, it's fine. This podcast is already too long. We'll come to Phil's Farside Chat.
They bore you, but like you just can't stop watching them, though.
Genuine question. Have you watched it more than once, Fionn?
No. Just the once.
Fionn? And the... I've watched it three or four times.
Have you?
I'm like trying to look deeper into the dynamic of what's going on.
Like reading the body language. Oh. Who's the alpha male here? All that stuff.
Like, Phil most Nicholson. Definitely, he's told Harrington what to say.
Absolutely.
Oh, it's a pretty approved story.
And Harrington's kind of afraid of him a little bit when he's telling the story. Well, wary. He keeps looking at him as if it's okay to tell you. And it's like, and also as well as, I'm sorry, but the story doesn't really make Mickelson seem like that decent a bloke.
No.
And I don't mean, no, but like, he's a bit of a, there's a bully in him or something. He's a bit of a bully.
Bit of joshing, all right, yeah. Some good, some serious male banter, I think, going on.
Oh my
Although I did like the way he signed off the Zach Johnson one with, usually I say, let's hit bombs and attack pins, but he was like, for you, Zach, I'm going to sign off by saying, let's hit cute little drives and aim for the middle of the greens. It was just so good. And Zach Johnson loved it. Zach Johnson thought it was hilarious.
Zach just couldn't believe he's been allowed back to the big time.
Yeah.
But do you know what? There's an element of, what's your man, the Australian golfer, is it Steve Elkington who was on? Yeah, there's a touch of the Elkingtons about it. It's like, basically, everything is designed ultimately as a humble brag. He's too fat and he's too stupid. And whereas what Mickelson is that, like, yeah, I beat him and then I hit a ball like so much further than this idiot. And
well, to boil it down, as with everything Mickelson does now, the key crucial question, which I'm still not entirely sure of the answer to, but it is crucial and it extends to Phil's Fireside Chats, is how much self-awareness is going on here?
Mm.
Is this a Ricky Gervais act of genius? Or is this one of the weirdest men on the planet?
Let's go with option B. Surely, to Christ.
I still kind of feel option A for some reason. But he's fully aware of how nerdy and like embarrassing dad he is.
Yeah. Think of his dance. He did the worm on TV.
That's true.
You know, I think he gets
it. But think of his audience that he is aware of.
Mm.
You know what I mean? It's a low bar.
Mm. Last point then. I think, in fairness, he's only won a major. We should give the listeners Shane Lowry.
Ah,
if
why
you don't
not?
Mind, I mean, they've listened to...
they've listened for 2 hours of us.
Oh, my God. The longest pod ever.
I've called this podcast the Shane Lowry interview.
Clickbait. So we better put the interview on.
Yeah. So this was on Tuesday. He was on the bus down to Clara for that amazing homecoming when we got him for about 10, 15 minutes and off the ball. We will at some stage get him in for a Golf Weekly special over the next, hopefully, 200 odd days when he's knocking around. So Fionn, thank you. What an amazing week. Appreciate it.
Thanks, guys. Brilliant.
Nathan,
brilliant.
I know you've got a busy day with off the ball to do, so thank you.
Cheers.
And we'll leave you with Shane Lowry. Very, very happy man speaking to us on Tuesday. We'll talk to you next week. Good luck.
And Ireland, there's your champion.
Well done, Shane Lowry. You've made us all so proud.
For all the hardship that he's gone through, for all the naysayers that said, you know, he'd never win a major, he needed to get fit, he needed to do this, he needed to do that, he's proved them all wrong.
He started this final round leading by four.
Play so well for 3 days, you have a four-shot lead. Now you're going to lose. It'll take some time to get
over. It's not easy to get yourself in a position I got myself in today, and it was there for the taking, and I didn't take it. But you can only learn from your mistakes.
Yeah, they're talking about my drop down the world rankings and talking about all that, but I'm not alarmed. 90th in the world at the minute. I mean, is it disastrous? Not really. Do you know what I mean? So, like, I remember being the happiest man alive when I broke into the top 100 a couple of years ago.
This to become the 2009 Three Irish Open champion, and he's done it. The pride of County Offaly.
Yeah, I feel like for me, I can kind of come in here a little bit more under the radar than the other guys. Like, you know, G-Max from here, he grew up here. You know, Rory's an hour down the road and Darren lives there now, so, you know, and Paddy has two of these already. So I feel like for me, I can kind of be more under the radar than everyone else.
Lowry at 16. First green he's missed. Oh, yeah.
Golden hands.
Yeah, let's hope he makes it. It'll be a big roar. Well done. Round of 67.
I'm fairly happy with 4 under. Look, if you had given me at the start of the day, I would have taken your hand off, I suppose.
Acceptable air of excitement around Port Rush with Shane Lowry's charge. What about this? Oh, and he's nearly popped it straight in for another birdie.
We all had smiles on our face. He had this permanent smile over the 4 days that nothing was going to get to him.
You start thinking about it when people start asking about it. So, look, I'll obviously be thinking about it tonight. Look, there's no point shying away from it. I'm in a great position, but my God, have we got a long way to go. Like.
The whole listen to the roar as the spectators realise that Shane Lowry and Bo, his caddy, had worked it out perfectly.
The line is gorgeous. It's absolutely gorgeous. Has he got it? Oh, it's just magnificent. The best shot we've seen all day at 16. Oh.
What is that? Shane Lowry.
I said the ball walking off to 17T. I said, we might never have a day like this on the golf course again, so let's enjoy this next half an hour.
These two have done something and shared something very, very special.
With a score of 269, the winner of the gold medal and the champion golfer of the year is Shane Lowry.
My family, what can I say? My mum and dad. They sacrificed so much for me when I was younger, and I'm so happy that I can hand them this trophy tonight.
Now then, you're very welcome back. So delighted to say he's joining us. I'm not quite sure where he is. He's on a phone somewhere. Shane Lowry, Open Champion 2019. How you doing?
I'm good, Joe. I'm good. I've been worse.
Open Champion 2019. You're going to have to get used to that eventually. I'm not sure where you are on that spectrum at the moment.
I suppose I'm not really used to it. Not really used to it. Like, it's mad, isn't it? I can't really believe it, to be honest.
I just can't believe how well you won it as well. Like, you're not meant to win by 6 shots, going really low on the Saturday, shooting a completely different round on the Sunday, a complete test of golf. You're not meant to walk up 18 in a party atmosphere. That's not how it's meant to happen.
I know, it's mad, isn't it? Like, it's, I suppose when I sit back and reflect on it, I'll realise that, like, to win and to win by 6, like, it's kind of, you know, I won it well, and I just... I played great all week, and I just was in a great place mentally, and I spoke about that before the tournament. Like, I felt good about how my game was, and my results this season have been pretty good. So I knew I was playing okay coming into it, but like, obviously didn't think I was going to win by 6.
No, sure. How can you, I suppose, when everybody out there is so good? I know you did feel good coming into it, and obviously you won it in Abu Dhabi. And you mentioned the chat with Neil Manship, your coach, on the Wednesday. Has that been blown up a bit too much, or was that a pretty important moment for you?
Yeah, look, I spoke about it a lot because people are asking about it. We have those chats an awful lot, but I suppose I was feeling particularly nervous and anxious last Wednesday. A little bit uptight about how the week was going to go. But look, you know, Neil obviously a huge influence on me, and he has been over the years, and he puts me in a great place, a great frame of mind when I get out to play my golf, and I love having him there. So yeah, I got myself to a place where I could go out and play my best golf. And after that chat on Wednesday evening, like I said, I could have went to the first tee there and then. So yeah, it was. I wouldn't say it's brought up too much, but it did have a big part to play in the whole week.
And when you say the mindset to play your best golf, what is that? Is that like free and easy, smile on my face, or is it like what?
Basically, not caring where the ball's going. You know, obviously you're aiming in the right direction and you're trying to hit it towards the flag and get in there in the least amount of shots. And yeah, and the consequences, basically having no consequences when you're playing golf. And that's the way I played all week. Obviously, it was a bit difficult as the week went on because you know, there was huge consequences at the end of the day. And I got myself to a place where I'm not sure if I've ever fully been there before, but I'll tell you one thing, it was really nice.
Wow, yeah. Freedom. It's one of the great ironies, isn't it? The more you care, the harder it is to play good golf. Because there was a great chat, and the mics picked this up. I don't know how much you've watched back, but on the Saturday, on the 10th, which was really a hole where you kick-started to a different level on the way to that 63, you and Bo, your caddy, were in big conversation, and he was telling you, it's definitely a 7-iron in, it's a 7-iron in, and, you know, you were worried about running up into the thick stuff, and in the end, you know, you had really good chat, back and forth, and you seemed to trust him, and you hit the 7-iron in, and it fed down, and you made birdie, and even on the TV, they were remarking on how well you two work together, even in those really, you know, those tough moments where you don't know exactly the right club.
Yeah, look, it's obviously, Bo's been a great influence to me over the last 10 months, and he's great. Like, he's so chill and so easygoing, and he's a good caddy. So to have him there, like, on my bag, and I suppose you don't know, like, until you're put in that situation, how good I'm going to be or how good he's going to be, how nervous we're both going to be. But I think the two of us handle it very well. And you know, it's great to be able to enjoy it with someone who's become a friend now. We're having great fun this week.
You know the way he signs off a lot of shots with, have you got your target? Have you got your target? Is that like an agreed thing, or have you just fallen into that habit?
That would be a thing that him and Neil would talk about, you know?
Right.
I sometimes get a bit complacent, especially when I'm playing well, about, you know, golf is a bit easy and I'm hitting good shots. And whereas if I'm really good at picking targets, I'll generally hit decent shots. So that's kind of, that would be him and Neil more than anything else.
Right.
Having conversations before we go out to play. Like, I was putting the pins in my yardage book before I went out on Sunday, and I seen him and Neil having a one-on-one before they went out. So that'd be just Neil trying to, you know, remind him that about the job that's at hand and what he needs to do to keep me in my best frame of mind.
Sometimes, often a golfer says he found a good swing thought on a week like this. Did you have a swing thought that you were relying on?
I actually didn't. The one thing I had last week was every putt I stood over standing there, especially when I got nervous, I just kept saying to myself, what's the worst thing that can happen here? You know, like, obviously the worst thing that can happen is with 3 or 4 putt, but you know, the worst thing that can happen is you miss the putt. Like, it's not the end of the day, is it? So, like you said earlier, I was picking good targets, and I had, you know, I found a drive, and I found a driver that I can hit, and I found like a low, squeezy fade that I can hit fairways with.
Right.
And I really had that last week, and that really worked well.
Yeah, that must be a huge comfort. I tell you what, I mean, when you were standing over that putt for bogey on the first on Sunday, you would have been doing well to say, "What's the worst that could happen?" That felt like a big moment.
Honestly, that 2 minutes on the first green was probably set the tone of the day. Like, if Tommy holds that and I miss, it's probably going to be a different day altogether. But it's I was obviously fortunate that he missed and I hold the putt. But like I said, I literally just tried to hit a good putt, and that's all I could do. And you know, sometimes you hit good putts that don't go in, sometimes you hit bad putts that do go in. But you know, you're better off just trying to hit a good putt and see where it goes.
It never looked on Sunday like you got gripped by the nerves. Like, even in that little bogey stretch, because that was the real teeth of the weather, everybody was coming, you know, struggling then. It never looked watching you at any point like he's nervous. Was that the case? And were you a bit surprised that that didn't happen?
Well, if it didn't look like that, it certainly wasn't that way, because I was, my stomach was in knots all day. Yeah, I couldn't stop thinking about, you know, winning, holding the trophy, being on the 18th, losing. You know, you kind of, everything goes through your head because you so much time to think out there, you know. Yeah. But Bo did a great job of keeping me, like, in the present and keeping me in a good frame of mind and, you know, trying not to get too far ahead of myself. But, you know, we talked a lot during the round on Sunday, which... Yeah. Which helped an awful lot.
And what was
one thing's for certain, I was definitely nervous.
Yeah,
there.
Well, geez, it really didn't come across. Because I was going to ask you then, the atmosphere on course with Fleetwood, it looked good. Like at one point, again, I'm working off cameras, you were walking off the green and you shouted back to Fleetwood's caddy, geez, let's get the Sambos out. I don't know if you remember that, but I was thinking, this fella's having a ball. It seemed like the atmosphere was pretty good with you two. Much talk or not too much talk?
Not too much talk. You're in the heat of the battle, but I'd be very good friends with Tommy and his caddy Finnall. Like, they're two great lads, and I get on very well with them. And I said to him actually Saturday evening, I was seeing him in the locker room. I said, you know, let's go out tomorrow and give it a go, and hopefully one of us wins it at the end of the day. Like, that's the way I was looking at it. And obviously, I was hoping that was me, but you're out there and you're out there playing with friends. You're trying your best. I'm obviously trying to make sure that I do the right things for me out there. And I enjoyed it. Saturday was probably one of the best days I've ever had in a golf course.
Yeah, I'd say,
you know,
so.
The crowd Saturday evening were just incredible. Sunday was obviously quite good, but like, I'll never, ever forget Saturday evening when I finished the round. It was just one incredible day. Like.
So your granny is now like a viral global superstar. She's like on the Golf Channel home website after her interviews yesterday. There's that, which is kind of funny. And then I wasn't aware of this as much, Shane, I must say, about your dad and just how hard he worked for you growing up. And it's the kind of conversation you'd rather do in person rather than on the phone when you're on a bus. I know you're travelling at the moment. But it's kind of worth touching on the fact that your dad worked incredibly hard for you guys. You know, he was tiling and working in the ESB as well. And like, geez, as a father, he held up his end of the bargain. I hadn't fully appreciated that until this week when I heard people talking about it.
Ah, yeah, look, I said it. My parents sacrificed an awful lot for me when I was growing up. And, you know, I'm not from a wealthy family or, you know, where, you know, my dad's good, hard-working man. Mm. And, you know, he sacrificed a lot for me. He drove me to certain, borrowed money to buy me golf clubs, stuff like that. Is, you know, to right. be able to hand him the claret jug, I don't know if you've seen pictures or videos of when I gave him the jug on the 18th green on Sunday after the presentation, him lifting the trophy.
It's
like,
hot,
he was going mental, and my mum was kind of standing there beside him, quite embarrassed. She's like, Brendan, stop, man. Yeah, well, it was quite funny. It was, it's just, isn't it? It's incredible. Like, to be able to, bring this home to Clara, like to my parents, down to my granny, my whole family, like, you know, I can't wait to see everyone, and it should be a great evening here.
That's amazing. Like, I hadn't realised, you know, borrowing money to pay clubs and all that kind of stuff, to be able to give your dad the claret jug, I mean, geez, that is, that's right up there.
You know, my dad, he doesn't miss many big tournaments, so to have him there, I always said I'd love to have him there when I win, but to be able to win in Ireland and have, like, all my immediate family there, and a lot of, like, my dad's brothers and sisters, my mum's brothers and sisters were there. Like, it's incredible, yeah.
Yeah, sure, look, you've ole ole ringing out at Royal Putrush.
Yeah.
I still don't think we've digested how mad it all was. Here, I know you're probably moving and walking. One kind of last thought to put to you, Padraig Harrington will be a great person for you to ask advice and talk to. He tells a great story about playing with Paul Laurie after Laurie had won the Open in 99, you know, the Van de Velde thing, and they were playing at some tournament a while later, and Laurie hits a bad shot into a par 3, and he really down on himself, and he kind of said out loud to himself, geez, Paul, that is not the shot of an Open champion. And it's a really good story about the pressure that can suddenly be on you now. You kind of almost say, you know, you almost need to be aware that your golf won't be perfect forever for the next 10 years, and like, you can suddenly put yourself under mad pressure. Do you have a sense, like, of wanting to kick on and win more of these things, or are you still just trying to digest what's happening, or, you know, that you move to a new level now is part of the Open experience?
I think you know, it hasn't all sunk in yet.
Sure.
I suppose when it settles down and I get back to practice the next week and getting ready for the FedEx Cup, I'll have to set some new goals. I think you know, obviously I'm a major champion now, so there's a bit of a label put on you there, but I'm going to try to be the person I've always been. I'm going to try and do things the way I want to do it. Obviously, it's going to be a little bit different going places now. But look, we'll I'm going to enjoy this week first. No matter what happens, I've got one big one in the bag. And hopefully, obviously, over the years, I could add to that. But, you know, obviously, it's not the end of the world if I don't. I've got one now. And like I said, I'll enjoy this and just see where it takes me from here.
So you're in Clara tonight. That's the plan.
I am. Yeah, I'm on my way down there now. Like, we're not far away, so looking forward to getting down there. But it's going to be it's going to be a bit mental down there, I'd say. But I'm looking forward to seeing what it's like.
I heard someone saying up to 20,000 people.
Yeah, that could be a bit mad, couldn't it? I never thought that this would be me, to be honest. And I feel very lucky, to be honest. I feel very, very privileged, very lucky that this actually happened to me. Like, I can't believe it, to be honest.
I'd say your phone's been hopping. You've been getting messages from so many people.
Yeah, I haven't even, to be honest, I haven't even got around to replying to a quarter of the people. I got an hour to myself this morning where I did some replying to messages, but it's, you know, I've had so many texts from so many people and so many of my peers, like, so it's incredible what just happened, yeah.
Yeah. Have you been a bit surprised, not surprised, but I guess you must be struck at how much the country was rooting for you. You know, maybe you haven't seen much media, but, like, the reaction has been overwhelming. Like, we've been quite spoiled for majors of late, and, you know, you'd kind of think we'd be getting used to it. But just how popular you are, you know, Croke Park reading out your score at half-time. Like, the place you kind of hold.
Mad, like,
yeah.
But I suppose I actually haven't seen that much. I've been very busy the last couple of days, and I haven't really had time to sit down and think about it. And I'm sure when the dust settles at the end of the week, I'll think about it. And then, yeah, it'll all start to sink in at some stage, hopefully.
Listen, I don't want to keep you. We'll probably sit down and have a proper chat sometime. But congratulations. Guys, it is just the most surreal thing. Open champion by 6 shots in Portrush. Well done.
Thanks, Joe. Cheers. Thanks very much.
Darker.